This audio is part of the Pen Machine Podcast at podcast.penmachine.com, also listed at blueberry, blubrry.com.
So, just to warn you, I am recording this, and the reason I'm doing that is so that I can put it on my website later and you can listen to it if you missed anything, or if you want to send it to somebody else or whatever. I will be rather long, obviously, so I'm going to break it into chunks. And I'm not sure how great the sound quality is. This weird white thing is a microphone. It actually does. It theoretically records in all directions, but it's mostly going to get me. I also do recording stuff, so I'll tell you a bit about myself. I'm Derek Miller. So yes, you're at the on-screen editing course. Anybody at the wrong course? No. Okay, good. It seemed like we were on the right track there. I've been a writer and editor in some form for more than 20 years, even though I'm only 37. I was involved with high school newspapers and. Helped start a couple at UBC when I was there. I have a marine biology degree, which I don't use much, and a nonfiction writing diploma, which I sort of use more. I first started doing word processing type stuff in about 1982 on an old Apple II system. I've used word processors on mainframes. I've used nearly every version of Microsoft Word that there's ever been. And I have changed less than you might think. I also work for a software company called, I'll show it to you on the screen here, called Maverick, which is here in Vancouver now by Science World. We make software for ocean shipping companies, web-based software. So I've written this entire website, and I write the daily blog for the company, just interesting stuff that I find useful. I have my own site, as you've seen there before, at penmachine.com. There's a new guitar I bought the other day. I'm also a musician, which is why I have it. Oh, here, I'll scroll it up. I'm also a musician. I work in a crazy 60s cover band called The Neurotics, which plays mostly weddings and corporate events. Down the right side here, you can see various things I'm involved in. Maverick's my company. I run a podcast. You know what a podcast is? Mm-hmm. Basically an internet radio show called Inside Home Recording, which is why I have this weird microphone. I put free music on the internet, which you're welcome to download and use and whatever. My wife has a podcast called Lip Gloss and Laptops, which is strange and popular. I'm involved with the Editors Association of Canada. And there's my other band. There's some photos. I do all that sort of stuff. I've been doing web. I've had this website since about 1997. I've written a blog on here something pretty much every day since late 2000. So there's probably something like 300,000 words worth or more of miscellaneous ramblings on there. And I do a lot of editing on screen. At my work, I'm the main guy that everybody takes everything through before it goes public. So if they write a 120-page proposal to go to Shell Oil, I'm the one who looks over it and formats it up to make sure that it looks right. If they're not sure how a particular error message that is 8 words long should be phrased, they ask me for that too. So it runs that whole range. That's my work. I do this stuff in a whole lot of contexts too. So I guess that's why I'm here. I've run a few seminars on Microsoft Word specifically. I also do some on web editing and things like that. If you actually go up here to the Editors Association link at the top, it gives you, these up here are links to the various seminars, including this one. So you can look at the old ones back there too. And some of them even have audio. My last web editing one, there's an audio transcript of that if you're interested in that stuff. So that's why I'm here. I've wrestled with Word for a very long time. I'm not especially fond of it. And there's a few reasons. If you go down this page, first of all, this is my favorite ever Word message. I came across it. This is an older Mac version that I came across. I don't know. I still don't know what it means. Yes, sorry?
No. You're not signed in.
Oh, sorry, you're not signed in. If you want to sign in, you won't need to. This is what you need to use. So press Control-Alt-Delete and use this wacky info here. So Control-Alt-Delete to log in. And then you need to type this HCC.
How do you turn that to a machine?
Is it not? Is it not? It's not even alive?
Yeah.
Okay. That would be helpful, wouldn't it? That's a good question.
Would be the big del button in front?
Besides the del button.
There we go. Oh, yeah, the black button that's on the black background. Perfect. Okay, so Word cannot edit the unknown. And unfortunately, I will not tell you how to edit the unknown. I just thought that was funny. Down at the bottom of this page, I have a few quotes from... And I'm going to complain about Word a bit at the beginning, and then we'll get into it. But why is it such a pain sometimes? You know, working with Microsoft Word, and in fact with any modern word processor, that it's frustrating because there's just a ton of stuff in there because it's trying to be everything to everyone. And here's why. This Rick Shout is one of the team who's worked on the Mac version of Microsoft Word for more than 15 years. And he says, there's no word processor, including Word, that's perfectly suitable for professional writers since they represent only a small portion of the overall market for word processors. In other words, if you are a professional writer and editor, Microsoft Word is not made for you. It's made for people who, like many of you actually, have writing as a significant part of your job, but it is not your job. So it is designed to do a whole bunch of things for all sorts of different people. What it is not designed to be is an efficient writing and editing tool for people who do that all day long. Unfortunately, it's also almost the only one we've got. So that is an idea. Here's another reason why it's such a pain. This was from last year, but we hired interns this past summer who were younger than Word's code base. What that means is there is programming code inside Microsoft Word that is now in excess of 20 years old. And if you've ever dealt with any kind of computer programming, you know that when you're dealing with code that somebody who may now be dead wrote before you were born, that can be difficult. Because computer code is not, I mean, it's sort of like reading Chaucer. You look at it and you kind of get it, but you don't really understand why they did things the way they did it. And trying to maintain that code and make it work on modern computers and make it interact with all the other stuff that's been built in the intervening 20 years is complicated, and it causes bugs. And it causes, one thing it also causes is strange things in the program that you can't understand why they're there, but they were there for a good reason when they first went in. And there's probably some 0.3% of the Word user base that depends on that stuff being there, even though nobody really wants it to use it. And if Microsoft took it out, those people would scream and yell and cry and complain. And so taking stuff out is difficult when you don't know exactly how people are using it. As evidence of how complicated it's become, here's what it looks like if you turn all of Word's toolbars on. Here is your editing area. Here's everything else. Is it perhaps a little more complicated than it needs to be? Probably. All of these things, some of these duplicate each other, but most of them are actually separate functions that you can perform here. And that's not even looking at what's underneath all the menus, of which there are so many that they've bumped some of the stuff I normally have in my menu bar out of the way. So this is what we're dealing with, and that's, you know, you need to understand that that is an issue and there's a reason. Now, I love this little ode to Word. Even though you, O mighty Word, are licensed to William Smith, I do not mean to type William Smith every time I type Will. You'll notice it does. I actually have a guy named Will Anderson in my address book, and every time I type the word Will, this little yellow thing pops up saying, Will Anderson! Not wanted, but it's trying to be helpful. Yeah. And this is another thing a friend of mine, Ryan, who's an architect, said to me once. He said that the problem with programs trying to be smart is that they're not. They're trying to be smart. He's an architect, and he said, well, if I want to use a table on the wall as a door, I should be able to do that because I'm an architect and I'm smart and I should know if I can do that. But if the program is smart and says, sorry, you can't put a table on the wall, all that means is it's limiting in what I can do by trying to be smart. And Word does the same thing. Oh, look, it looks like you're trying to write a letter. Can I help you? No, go away. So how many times, how much time do you spend telling Microsoft Word, no, that's not what I want? Yeah, in fact, there's one bug that has confounded me and still has yet to be, it's gotten better. Back in, I guess, 1995, which I think was Word 6, they introduced the automatic numbering of lists. And I still cannot get it to work the way I want. If you have a list and you're up to number 13, and then you want to start another list that starts at number 1. Sometimes it will, and sometimes it won't. Sometimes it'll go to 14. Sometimes you want it to go to 14, but it decides to start at number 1. Sometimes it decides to be a bullet instead. Sometimes it decides to renumber everything in your whole document as one big long list so that the stuff at the end is number 127. I wish I could tell you how to fix that. I'll show you a few things that might work, but my best advice is undo. As soon as it does that, undo and then try something else, because that seems to be the only way I can consistently fix that. So that's another issue. And then this last one, Joel Spolsky, who's a really smart programmer who now runs his own software in New York City, used to work on Microsoft Excel, which is part of the Office suite. And he said, it's kind of weird, but everything that's happened in Office since about 1995 has been more or less user interface churn. Oh, let's put in the paperclip. Let's take out the paperclip. Or slightly redoing the toolbars, and then you have to do it for every single product. There's all this flotsam that's not actual core functionality of the product, but just crap on top of it. It's good crap, but once you get to 100% crap, so this is his issue with the way Office, and this is part of this whole historical thing. Every time a new version of Office comes around, they seem to change stuff just because. Track changes is a perfect example here. The track changes functionality is basically the same as it has been since they introduced it about 10 years ago. The basic thing that Word is doing is the same. The way you work with it changes every time they release a new version. Which means nobody, if you're looking at how you interact with it, it seems like they're changing it every time, and they're not really. So we'll get to that. So here are the things that I want to cover today, or that I don't want to miss. One is to understand that every Word document has a normal soul and is also a six-layer cake. That will make more sense once I get to it. How to turn off the crap, but turn on the goodies. Sections, paragraphs, and characters are Word's favorite things. What this means is Word doesn't care about pages. We'll get to that. Learn to love styles, if you don't already. Create tables of contents and other things. Use bookmarks, cross-references, and variables. These are all sort of tips, but I find them really useful. Enjoy the views. There are different ways to look at your document. Paste specially. This is a fun one. Just under the bed, comments and track changes. I still don't understand comments that well, but we'll cover it. And set languages and spelling in blobs. I'll show you that a little later. Bonus tips. This is something I'm not sure. There's probably a way to do it in the Windows version. It is in the Mac version. This is where you can select chunks of text that are not actually together, which is very handy and very good. And plain old ASCII is your friend online. This is outside Word. But what I'll just summarize this one. If you're writing email or web pages or anything that's not a Word document, ASCII text, which is the basic, dumb old text that most people deal with on their computers and have for 30 years now, the one without the curly quotes, without the M dashes and the N dashes and the accents and all that stuff, that's the only thing you can be that you can rely on if you're sending text around that's not inside a Word document, if you're putting it on a web page or sending it in an email. Any other characters you put in there, there's a good chance they'll get gorped up somewhere between when you send them and where they go. So that's my last tip there. Okay. On the CD I'm going to give you, there are a bunch of files. You can also find exactly the same files on the website here from the link at the bottom of this page. So when you get the CD, the files that we'll be working with later are on there, and there is also a link to them on the CD, or you can go to penmachine.com/word, which gets you to this page, and the link's at the bottom. So you can always get at these files on the web, even 5 years from now, provided my server doesn't crash. So all this stuff is on the website. Okay, let's get back to our agenda and see where we are. Okay, so let's get some more background about Word. Oh yeah, have you got your sign-in stuff there yet? You don't actually need to do much on the computer. If you want to follow along and try some of the stuff I'm going to be doing, that's great. I'm just going to kind of be rambling on for a while. If you want to do stuff on the computer, great. If not, if you just want to sit there and listen to me ramble, that's fine too. So, we're going to talk a bit more about Word's background. I've done that a bit. I found after, 15 years of working with Word, I finally found a book, which I linked down here, that actually told me what was going on. And it's this one, linked in here, called Word 2000 in a Nutshell. Let me get the U.S. version. If you go to the U.S. site, you can actually inside the book on Amazon's thing. So you click look inside here. And theoretically, you could actually read the whole book on the website, which is annoying, but it works. So it has the whole thing, all this stuff. So anyway, it's Word 2000 in a nutshell. Yes, it's about Word 2000, which is now 6 years old. And there have been, what, four or five versions. Anyway, it gets you through the whole book. What it is it's from O'Reilly, the technical publishing company. And the guy who wrote it essentially said, okay, I'm going to go into what Word is and what it does and why it's that way. And I read through this book and just sucked it right up, because even though it's about a version of Word that's 6 years old, the fundamental concepts that it talks about are still true. And I finally understood some stuff that I'd never gotten before. And the key one about that is, we'll talk about our six-layer cake that I was mentioning before. Or I think it's six layers. It's a layer cake, anyway. If we go down here to the files. There is this picture in here. Now, you might think, looking at a Microsoft Word document, that you sort of imagine it like a piece of paper. You imagine it as this flat thing with some words on it and maybe some pictures and whatever else. But that's not how Word thinks of it. Well, the way a Word document is constructed, from a sort of metaphorical sense, is as this six-layer cake. So what it means is, whenever you have a document that looks like this in Word, you've got six layers going on. The main layer that you're probably mostly working in is this layer number two, called the text layer, sensibly enough. But how often have you had something in Word, a reasonably complicated document, and there's been something that sits on top of or in behind something, and you can't figure out why it's on top of or in behind, and you can't get it to where, it just keeps blocking what you're trying to do, or you can't get it to come up. Well, this is why. Because in addition to this text layer, there is a drawing layer, if you use the drawing tools in Word, that sits in front of the text layer. And that drawing layer can include text, sensibly enough. If you create a thing like a text box, or they call it frame. As this is one, there's a thing called a frame, which was in old versions of Word, and it's still there because you need to be able to put in those documents, but you're not really supposed to use it anymore. And it can show up in this front drawing layer. Or it could be in the back drawing layer, which is in behind the text. How exactly you get things in the different layers, I'm still not entirely clear. But anyway, this layer exists. Now, in addition to that, there's a whole other section down here that's the headers and footers. So when you create a header or a footer in Word, which can be at the top or bottom of the document, or can actually be as long as the whole page, it's actually in behind everything else. So, for example, if you create, one of the old ways to do a watermark on a Word document was to put it in the header and just put draft or whatever in gray, and it would be behind everything, but it would go across the whole page. So to get rid of that, you'd have to double-click the header and then the big draft thing in the middle and delete it if you wanted to delete it. There are other features to do that now, but you can still run across documents like that. And the header and footer layer is exactly like the rest. It has a text layer and a front drawing layer and a back drawing layer. So theoretically, if you have something that's in the header and footer back drawing layer, there is no way you're going to be able to get it in front of anything else in the document unless you actually cut it and paste it somewhere else. So even though I don't entirely understand, at least as far as I've seen, there's nothing like in Photoshop where you can actually see the layers and move them around or say, no, I want this to go to the back and this to go to the front. I have yet to discover exactly how you move things between these layers, but just knowing that this is what Word is really doing will let you go, ah, okay, now I think I understand why that thing keeps getting stuck behind everything else. So I have a picture, and the text keeps going over top of it, and I want the text to go around it, or I want it to be in behind. You can probably copy it and paste it somewhere, and it'll end up in a different layer, and it'll work better for you. So just remember this. There's a link to this image in the files section on the website on the CD I'm going to give you. Front drawing layer, text layer, back drawing layer, header footer front drawing layer, header footer text, and header footer back drawing layer. six layers in any Word document, even if you just say file new and type the word hello, you have all these six layers there. You're just going to be using one of them. So that's good to know. The second thing to know is that every Word document, the thing I said before, that every Word document has a normal soul. And what I mean by that, and again, I really don't understand this completely, but if you're looking at a Word document, it's not, again, it's not just a single file, really. You think of it as a single file that says, you know, .doc, whatever it is, file, .doc, or whatever. That's what, you know, you think of it, and it's got some text on it, and maybe some pictures or whatever. But the thing about it is that it actually sort of has a soul. And what that soul is this file that you might have seen before, the name of which, you've only ever seen it in error messages or pop-ups, called normal, or normal.dot, for document template. And this is a file that lives somewhere on your computer. It depends on what kind of computer you have and which operating system you've got as to where this actually resides. But when you install Word, it installs this file called normal.doc. And it is a Word document template. It's basically a normal Word document that's set as a template that you can't actually, that normally when you open it, you can't edit it right away. It makes a new file. And in that is a whole bunch of the generic information about what a plain old Word document you create from scratch is going to do. What fonts it's going to include. So when you start typing, is it Times New Roman or is it something else? That's in here. When you do a first level heading, how big is it? Is it bold? What font is that in? What are the margins? That's in here. In different versions of Word, sometimes even the toolbar settings and other things like that are stored inside this normal.doc file. And if you sit down at a version of Word that's really screwed up, that, you know, you try and type something and it comes up a really weird font, nothing really works, what you can do is you can actually hunt and delete that file, and Word will make a new one that's the generic one that it would have had when it installed itself. And let's see if I can figure out how to do that on here. Now, if you're using Windows, you can actually just go to search, start search for files or folders. And depending on which version of Windows you have, it could be, okay, and in this case, we're going to press all, I'm going to say all files or folders. And I'm going to say I'm looking for the file called normal.dot. And it will churn away for a while. And with any luck, it'll find something. It may take a while. But if you find that, now, rather than deleting it, what you can do is drag it to the desktop and give it a different name or something like that, so you have that one. And next time you launch Word, it will create a new generic version of this normal template. And anytime you create a new file, Word looks at this normal.doc file and uses that as the basis for the file you create. Now, it gets more complicated than that, unfortunately. This is the way a normal file will work, but once you start working it, theoretically you can change what the soul of that document is. It doesn't seem to be finding it on my machine, but whatever. Probably because I'm looking in too many places. But when you're in Word, notice it's taken me 40 minutes before I actually launched the program we're talking about. Okay, so we're in Word here, and if you make some changes to... Oh, geez, this is different from what I'm used to. Anyway. I'll figure it out later as to how this works. Anyway, if you start changing what the styles are in a document, for example, the things that change the fonts, there is a little checkbox often in there that says add to template. So for example, if you change a level 1 heading from Times New Roman 24 point bold to Arial 32 point bold underlined in a style, and you say apply the template, what that does is that saves that style sort of in the background to the template of this file. Now that, and that sort of travels with the file while you move it around. So if somebody else opens that document on another computer, they will also see the headline in the proper font, and if they apply that style, it will be in the style that you be the Arial 32 point bold underline that you did. So when you make a change in a style, and we'll get to some of that later, in Word, you can choose to include that in the soul of the document, or you can just make it sort of the change that you do. What this leads to, and the reason it's an issue, is that typically, and this is something that happens to me all the time, you will create, say, what I do is a proposal. And I base that proposal on the last proposal we did. So I open up the last proposal we did, and I change stuff, and then I save that again. But, you know, maybe I mock stuff around. And over several generations, you can end up with this associated template soul file in here that's got a whole bunch of weird changes to the various styles. And so when you try to go do something and say, okay, well, I want to make a bulleted list, sometimes then the bullets sudden magically into infinity signs or strange characters that you weren't expecting because it has several generations of changes that have occurred to this file. And the styles and various other things have gone through a bunch of permutations, and it doesn't—it sort of doesn't know where it came from anymore. So that all comes out of the fact that each document, it has an associated template, and a lot of the time when you start off, that template is the normal .dot file on your computer. That's really confusing.
Same way if you take a file and put on somebody else's computer, and it's all.
Well, to a degree it can be, because if it's, if the document you have is referring, it has its own sort of styles and formatting in there, but anything that isn't specific to that document, it will refer to the normal dot dot file. And if the one on the computer you take it to, so say you've changed the headings and you've changed a few other things, but most of your document is just in the normal style, and you haven't done anything to that on your machine. If somebody else has on their machine, when you take it to their machine, it might look and say, okay, I'm going to look at the normal dot dot template, and oh, it's in, the normal font is 3-point Palatino. So you open up that document, and it looks totally weird, because it said, well, normal is this normal that they've made on this machine, and that's where this problem is coming. Now, again, a lot of the things I'm going to be talking about, there may not be a particular tip I can give you to address that specific situation, but knowing that this file and your file have styles and stuff that are intermingling from a bunch of templates that sort of exist there as souls in the background gives you something, gives you a bit of understanding that lets you go, okay, well, maybe I can figure out a way around this. My typical way that I might often do this is if you select the entire document, copy it, make a new document and paste it in the new document, sometimes that fixes a whole bunch of stuff. Even though all you're doing is copying and pasting the exact same content. Weird, but sometimes it works. Okay, so let's get back to our outline here and see what we're talking about. Alright, so I'm actually going to go to number 3 first, which is sections, paragraphs, and characters. When you create a new Word document, what you have, let's go back to Word here. And I type a single character, A. So that's about as simple a Word document you could have. As I said, it's got 6 layers. It's referring to this normal template. It probably has its own template associated with this file when you send it around. There's a whole bunch of stuff going on here. But the key thing to know here is that Word, as I said, doesn't care about pages. Word doesn't think in pages, and in fact, for the longest time, back in the 80s and 90s, this was really the only way you could look at a Word document, was without any kind of page representation at all. It was just a long, scrolling document. And that is still the way that Word, and actually most word processors, think of things, because if you change what printer you're using, or you change the margins, or you do anything else, that totally changes how the pagination works. Sometimes to your detriment. But what Word thinks of is really in terms of three things. And those are sections, paragraphs, and characters. So in a Word document, in this Word document, we have all three of those things. This letter A here, this document is a single section with a single paragraph and a single character. But Word is looking at all of those things. So a character, reasonably enough, is one of these things. So it can be a letter, number, weird symbol. In fact, if you paste an image in line into your document, it treats that as a character. If you're not pasting it into the sort of graphics layer where you can manipulate it around, if you just say, you know, say you're in another program, you copy a photograph of somebody and you paste it in here where the cursor is, it treats that as a character, like a letter. And you can highlight it and you can copy and paste it and you can move it around. So there are characters. That character lives in a paragraph, and one of the things I typically advise is, where are our toolbars? Formatting. Where's our paragraph marker thing? Okay, there, that's what I want. I typically like to leave this paragraph marker thing turned on, because that ends up being important. Because within this, let's make another paragraph. Okay, now we have two paragraphs. And if you have the paragraph display turned on, it puts this paragraph symbol at the end of every paragraph. That's important, because how many of you have had a long Word document where you copy several paragraphs worth of stuff and you paste it somewhere else, and the formatting changes? Yes, Celia. So you paste it somewhere, and suddenly it takes on the formatting of where you pasted it, which is not what you wanted. Or conversely, you paste something, and where you paste it suddenly all changes into what the same formatting that you're pasting in, and you don't know why. Well, I'll tell you why. Because all the formatting of a paragraph is stored in this paragraph marker at the end of the paragraph. You can actually, as you notice, I selected that without actually selecting anything in the paragraph. So there are basically two kinds of formatting Word. There's character formatting, which applies to individual characters. So you can make an individual character italic, for example. Or you can make a series of them italic, but it's sort of like applying that to each individual character. And there's paragraph formatting, which applies to the whole paragraph. So that deals with things like margins. And a lot of the styles, like if you're in the middle of a paragraph and you apply a headline style to it, like say, let's try it here. I go blah, 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 I've got something here. And I'm in the middle of a paragraph and I click heading one. The whole thing changes because that's a paragraph style. And in fact, if you look over here in the style menu, if you look at all the styles that are available, you can see that some of the styles, these ones, with a little A next to them, those are character styles. Here. So it's got a little letter, that's a character style, and if you apply that, it will only apply to the character or characters you have highlighted. Paragraph style will apply to everything in the current paragraph. In other words, it really applies to this invisible, most of the time, paragraph marker at the end of the paragraph. And the reason I recommend leaving this displayed on, even if you don't display any of the other hidden things, is that that will show you whether you've selected it or not. So that will tell you, you know, if I want to copy and paste this, if I only want to copy and paste the text, and usually it gets it automatically, but say I only want to copy and paste this. No, I don't want that last one. See, it's trying to be helpful again. Okay, so I've highlighted everything except the paragraph marker. If I go edit, copy, and then I paste that in here, edit, paste, notice that it didn't bring the formatting with it. On the other hand, if I grab these and the paragraph marker, edit, copy, and then paste it in here, paste, it pastes in all the formatting because I brought the paragraph marker with me. Yes, and changed my other one as well. I don't know quite why that's so, but anyway. Well, yeah, I changed my other one because that's part of the same paragraph that I pasted it into.
So if you were to delete that paragraph marker, would that...
Let's find out. No, what it did is it actually sucked that into it applied that to the next paragraph. But if you do it a slightly different way, does that work? No. If I were to go down here and base, well, that still doesn't work. There's a way to do it. I just can't think of it offhand. But essentially, if you think of all the paragraph formatting as being stored in that paragraph end mark, that helps you a lot. Because then when you're copying and pasting, you know whether you're copying and pasting all those paragraph styles. And the other way to look at it is the paragraph style is the basic, that's the basic style of any chunk of text, and the character styles usually go on top of that. So within a paragraph, you can make things italic or boldface or blue or a link or any of these other things. And that applies on top of the paragraph style. And if you copy and paste the text without the paragraph marker, those other character styles will flow through. So, as an example here, if I... actually, I already had it in a place where I could do... How do I redo? Oh, of course. This is one of the things I'm going to recommend turning off, which is the two smart menus. So, format, styles... So, let's say I'm going to pick a character style like this that's got italic in the middle. If I now take this chunk of text and copy and paste it, you'll notice that the IZ is still italic, even though it hasn't taken the paragraph style with it. So character styles will go with the characters that they're in, and paragraph styles will only go with that paragraph marker. So in fact, the best thing to think of is, it's not really the text at all, it's just this thing at the end of the paragraph that you're moving, and whether the text comes along is sort of your choice. So what happens if I just do this? I pasted just the paragraph marker and it actually moved the whole style there. I didn't do any of the text at all. So that's possible to do. So that's a good thing to know. And sections, again. When you work with Word, you can do a page break, and all that is a pure formatting thing. That will make the next page. The Word doesn't really care. All that's saying is, well, if you're in the middle of a page, go to the next one. You can make a section break of any type. So if you're in a Word document and you want to make a new section, you go insert break, and it gives you a lot of choices. Page break, column break, text wrapping break, all sorts of things like that. But section breaks, you can have a section break that goes to the next page, a section break that continues on the same page, a section break that forces the next page to be on an even page or an odd page. But each of those section breaks, what that enables you to do is every section in a Word document can have its own headers and footers. That's the usual main thing. And you can restart numbering at new sections. So you can have, you know, section 2-1 for the first page of the second section. The sections let you divide a document up into chunks. And often that's very handy if, for example, you don't want the first page to have page numbers on it because it's a title page. You do that without anything in the headers and footers. And then you create a new section. And in that one, you add some headers and footers with page numbers, and the first page doesn't have that. I used to do that, before I understood this, what I used to do is I would use the drawing tools and I would make a white rectangle, which I would paste over the footer so that you couldn't see it, but it was still there. That was my thing before I figured out sections. Now, they were there. Sections have been there almost since the beginning, but I didn't get that. So that's an easier way. In fact, that's something I started doing in PageMaker as a layout program. I'm sure there was a way to get around that, too. The other thing I'd like to emphasize is that's okay. If you find some weird technique like that that works for you, and you can use it consistently, and you really don't expect anybody else to be working with your document and trying to figure out what you're doing, that's fine. But it's better to use the tools that exist in there for those who might understand them. Now, on the other hand, some of the tools, like track changes, you might have to use, and nobody really understands them. And there would probably be better ways of doing them, and that's sometimes when I recommend using paper. Because I still do use paper a lot. And I'll get to that as well. So, the turn off the crap, I'm going to deal with that a little bit later, but... Learning to love styles. How many of you use styles in Word religiously? Yes? How many of you even know what I'm talking about? You know what a style is in Word? Yeah. Okay. This is something that I didn't do for the longest time. You know, typically, and this is one of the places where Word really falls down, even in the role that it's designed for. It's designed for people who are just doing writing all the time. It never really makes it that easy for you to use styles, even though that's what you should do almost all the time. Typically, if you sit down at a Word document, or this is the first time you've ever used Word, you sit down, you start typing, and you say, oh, I want to hit it. So you grab a bunch of text, and you make it bold-faced, and you make it big, and whatever. And then you go down, you want another heading, and you grab that chunk of text, and you make it bold-faced, and whatever size. And maybe you forgot what you did, so you make it slightly different size, and whatever else. And then somebody else has to come back and edit your document. And it's basically all in one style, with a bunch of formatting applied to it, that, you know, now they want to try and apply it to, they want to try and change those styles to meet the corporate standard or whatever, and they have to go through the whole document and fix it all up. This is why I met with a book designer once, and he said, I want you to send your files to me as plain text files. I don't even want Word documents. I want a TXT file. In fact, you don't even have to have curly quotes in there or anything. Just send me the plain text, because I don't want to deal with all the crap that you've put in there. I'm going to format it up the way that I know how to do it, because it's more work to try and fix up a Word document than it is. Usually, it's more work to do that than it would be to just start over with the plain text and mark it up again, because there's more stuff to undo. What you should be doing when you're writing a Word document... Let's close this one. Oh, that's not what I wanted to close. No. So let's make a new document. Blank document. Okay. So when you make a new document, really what you should be using is this menu up here. So if you're typing, say, I want a level one heading, I want to type, this is a level one heading. Now, you notice what happened there. It gave me a level one heading. As soon as I hit return, it started typing in normal text. Isn't that nice? That's because the way the headings are set up is that at the end of the paragraph, there's actually a thing in there that says, well, what should I do when you get to the end of the paragraph? Should I keep going in this style, or should I go to some other style? And if you go to, here is the actual, sorry, format, styles and formatting. Now, I'm used to Word 2000 and Word on the Mac. It actually comes up with a dialog box here instead of this sidebar thing. But anyway, any of these... So here are the styles, and it says these are available formatting. If you click at the bottom, you can actually say all styles, and it'll show you everything. Now, these are the type of things that I was talking about in this normal template. When Word gets installed, it has a normal template that has all these styles defined in. And there's actually dozens and dozens of them, and all sorts of strange slurs. So body text, headings down to level 9. I don't know, if you're ever working on a document and you get to a ninth level heading, it's time to start over. I can't imagine. I mean, other than the manual for the 747 that they don't use this document for, I don't think ninth level headings are useful. So there's a whole ton of these things in here, and they're all defined as a certain font at a certain size with certain margins and all that. And so chances are, when you create a document, there's going to be one of these styles that would be useful for whatever you're doing at the moment. And what I'm talking here is, generally, I'm talking about paragraph styles. So headings, bulleted lists, your main body paragraphs, table, the contents inside tables, tables of contents themselves, so the actual table of contents areas, various sorts of things, the headers, the footers, they all have styles. And by default, they all use a certain style. But when you start typing in a Word document, typically... I can't type anymore. There we go. By default, the main text is called normal. This is not the same as normal dot dot, unfortunately. It's the same name, but it's a totally different thing. This is basically the default style inside that normal template. This is, unless you do anything else, this is what you're going to be typing in Word. I personally prefer not to use this. When I'm typing in a I want to use something like body text, which actually usually looks exactly the same. But the thing about that is that if... Let's try... I'm just going to type something up. This is a level 2 heading. Hello. Again. Okay. So I go up here and I say, well, it's a level 2 heading. I'm going to go up to up here. And see, it's got this huge long list. You can always just type it in, too. I go heading 2, magazine level 2 heading. Okay, so if I apply my styles like this, and say I do that over and over again, so I type a huge long document that's all like this, and it just goes on and on. With any luck, it's more sensible than this, but say I have that. Now, if I go over here to the heading section, and I click on this little arrow on here, depending on which version of Word you're using, this might be inside a dialog box or whatever else it is, but basically if you go format, styles, and formatting, at some point you'll be able to modify heading 2. I clicked on this arrow, or I could right-click on it and say modify. And it brings up this dialog box, which is what hasn't changed in years and years. So it tells you a whole bunch of things about this style that are really interesting, and this is why styles are useful. The name of the style, what kind of style it is. So if you create a new one, you can define whether it's for a paragraph style or whatever. What is it based on? So here's a nice thing. For example, if you can set up your heading styles so that your level 4 heading is based on your level 3 heading, which is based on your level 2 heading, which is based on your level 1 heading. So that if you decide to change the font of the level 1 heading, and all the other headings are based on that, the font, so you decide, well, I don't like Arial anymore, I got this new font that's super font scheme, then all those headings, all the way down the line, right to heading 4 or 9 or whatever, will all change into that font, but at the different sizes you've set. So you could do that, for example. But here, this one's based on normal. I could say, well, no, I want to base it on heading 1. And then any time I change anything in heading 1 that isn't specified in here, it isn't specified separately inside this style, that will change when I change heading 1 as well. So it sort of cascades through the styles. A little bit confusing, I know. And here's the part I was talking about before, style for the following paragraph, normal. So a heading style, this makes sense. But what I would do typically is I would say, oh no, I want that to be body text. So now, if I were to type a level 1 heading and hit return, I would get the body text style after it. And look at the body text style over here. It's based on normal, but it has a few changes, some space after and whatever. And the style for the following paragraph is also body text. So if you're in body text and you hit return, you're still in the same style as you go down. So different styles for different purposes will work differently. But what you can do here is you can create a sort of generic document. Set up a bunch of these things you might want to do, headings, bulleted lists, body texts, indent paragraphs, whatever else. Set them all up exactly the way you want them. And then you say file, save as, and you make it a Word template, document template. And you can save it. There's a templates folder that it would normally put it in. You can save it on your desktop. You can do whatever. And if you open that template file, you will start with your brand new document with all these things defined the way you want them. And then you can go on and start working. The nice thing about that is that, say, I decide, okay, I don't like this level 1 heading anymore. I want to say, I want to change this style to, I want to change what that looks like. I'm going to go over here and say modify. And if you go down to this format menu down here, you can change a whole bunch of things about that. I want to say, okay, well, I don't like Arial anymore. I want it to be Gil Sans Ultra Bold. I'm going to be ridiculous here. 72-point italic strike through. I don't know. Let's try something else. Shadow. That doesn't even look like the outline. There we go. I go okay. Now this is that part I was talking about before. See this add to template? This will add it to the soul of this particular document so that anytime you use this style in the future, it will be what you're defining here. If you don't do this, when you send the file to somebody else, they might not get the same formatting that you've set up. So this is a wise thing to do when you're setting up a template. Again, I'm still not entirely clear on exactly when this does things and when it doesn't. I sort of have to muck around with it. And unfortunately, this is what we get a lot. But let's say, okay, the other thing is automatically update. Do not check this box. Because what this does is, you, for any given style, you can make it so that okay, if I decide to change on the fly editing a document, if you check this, if you later decide, okay, well, I'm going to make this not italic and resize it and whatever, it will change all the other headings that are in that style, all the other paragraphs in that style, as soon as you make the change. So what that means is as you're editing your document, you're changing stuff about other parts of the document you can't even see right now, and you discover later on that that style, you ended up automatically updating it when you didn't want to. So I always uncheck this, because I hate it doing that. But anyway, if I say okay here now, you've noticed that all my level one headings have now turned into this monster font through the entire document. Now, if you change that to one that was actually attractive, that would be useful. But you've also noticed that the level two headings, they've also changed to outline, but because I defined the font separately for the level two heading, it kept the font that I told it to be, but it sucked all the other stuff and the size as well, but it sucked the other formatting out of the level one, because remember where I said it was based on level one? So you can do, what I would recommend is that you start playing around with this. Sit down, create a new document, save it as a template, and try to make that the official template that you like to use all the time. And you make all the stuff in there the way you like it. Because the generic way that Word is set up, the default template, isn't that great. I mean, Times New Roman is actually not a very attractive font on the screen. So maybe you want to pick something else that's easier for you to read. And you want to make the headings more different from one another, so that you can tell on site whether it's level one or whatever else. Yes.
If you saved it as a template, if you just named it normal dots,
yeah.
So it would overwrite the normal.
Then that would be what.
It would be every single document.
Every single document you ever started in your Word would start that way.
Okay.
So that is a good thing. I wouldn't recommend just overwriting the one that's there. What I would recommend doing is setting up this default template that you like, you know, on the desktop or whatever. And then when you've got it exactly the way you like it or close enough, then find the normal dot dot template, rename it to something else, usually as a safety valve, because you can always bring it back, and then save the one you have as your new normal. And then whenever you go file new, you'll get your template instead of the generic Word one. And that can be very handy. I've done that for work, so that I mean, have the essentially generic version of our official, you know, we have official fonts that we use and whatever else, and they're all in there, so that I don't have to change it every time. Unfortunately, when people send me documents, sometimes they've got embedded formatting that I have to change all over again. I'll show you some tips and tricks about that later. But anyway, styles are your friend. If you can use particularly paragraph styles, I don't really care. I mean, if you're just making something italic, I just do Control I and make it italic. But for example, if you have something like you have a particular style when you're writing a web address, that you have one in a certain font or whatever, if you have a character style that applies to that, then if you just change your mind later and you want those all to look different, you can do that. The other nice thing you can do over here is if you click on this, see where it says select all 9 instances? Now it's actually highlighted every single time that that style appears in the entire document. So you can see they're all highlighted. So I could actually change them all to body text, just like that. And that wasn't even changing the style, that was just applying a different style to all those things. And in fact, you can do that. Where is it even in here? You can do that by finding multiple instances of something. So if you have one of those documents where everything's kind of screwed up and they didn't use styles, if you say, well, I want to find. Let me show you how this works, because it's pretty cool. If I can figure out where the find is. Control F, is that it? Yeah. So find and replace. If I find, if I click this more button in the find window, it gives me an option to find formatting. Not just to find text, but to find any text that's in a certain format. So say I want to find anything in the document that is in Times New Roman. So if you notice, what it's saying here is, it says, find what? Find nothing or anything in the font Times New Roman. So when I click find, and then I check this, highlight all items found in main document. You can also tune, well, if you have headers and footers, you can find things just in the headers and footers, for example. But highlight all items, find all. Now, interesting thing here is it's found, these are all in a different font right now. It has found all the spaces in between here that are all in Times New Roman. So I've actually searched for a space because I had a space there. That's not quite what I meant to do. Let's try that again. Okay, so if you have nothing there, it'll find... Why is that? Okay, I'm confused now. It should only find things in that font, and I don't know what it's done there. But anyway, you can find... Say you find... I guess, oh yeah, that probably
is. Based on level one.
Yeah, but it's in a different font, so it shouldn't be highlighting it. But anyway, if you play around with this, you can find different chunks of the document that it will select all at once, and you can change them all at once into something else. You can turn them into a style. So if you've got somebody who's made all their headlines Arial, but they didn't actually make them styled, you just find all the instances of Arial in the document, and then you say, turn those all into heading one. And it just does it. So it's a good way to fix up something like that. Again, these are all just emphasizing that styles are your friend. And so when you're working with documents in Word, I recommend you use paragraph styles in particular as much as you can, because what that gives you the flexibility to do is to go back later and change the formatting without having to go through the entire document to do it. You can say, okay, you know, these people want everything in Courier New. Because, well, one thing I remember is that it used to be that if you were submitting some sort of legislative brief to the United States government, it had to be in Courier. It had to look like it was on a typewriter, even though it wasn't. So if you had written a document in Times New Roman, they wouldn't even accept it if it wasn't in Courier. I think they've now changed it so that it has to be in Times New Roman, which still is ugly, but whatever. So they have these very specific formatting requirements, so that, you know, a bill or a draft or a law or whatever. So if you went through the whole document and had to change particular instances, that would suck. But if you just said, okay, I'm going to change all my body text to Courier, you're done. So that's great. Okay, so what time are we at? 10:15. Okay, we're rolling on. So the other thing that's worth knowing about is the views, and I showed you these already. Word has a whole bunch of different ways of looking at the document. And here is the third occasion of the word normal. Again, we're talking about a different normal. This is our third normal, again, totally unrelated to the other two normals. We have the normal template. And if you're on a Mac, it's not normal dot dot, it's just called normal. We have the normal template, which defines what a generic document is going to look like. We have the normal style, which, when you have a generic document, it is the basic style on which all other styles are based. And we have the normal view, which is none of those things. This is the view that Word had for the longest time. And the only way you could see what your pages would look like is if you did a print preview and it showed you where the pages would break and what the pages would actually look like with the margins. So normal is just a big, long, continuous scrolling document like we've got here. And it does show you where the pages break, but only with a line like this. Oop. This is actually a good view to work in if you're writing or editing a document and you don't want to think about how many pages it is or what the margins are like. You can get as much of the text on the screen as possible. And in fact, if you go normal and go view full screen, then you got a lot to work with. You can just keep typing and typing, and you don't see any of the formatting bars or anything else. Not so good for applying styles, but if you're just writing and you're not doing anything about the styles except maybe italics and bold, that's a good view to look at. The one you're probably more used to is the print layout, because this is the way it usually comes now when you start up Word. And it does show you the edges of the pages, and when you get to a bottom of a page, you see the divisions, and you can zoom in and out the different... So you can zoom and say, well, I want the whole page on screen like that. So this is page view, and it shows you what it should look like when you print it out, and usually it's pretty accurately stated. Now what's interesting is that there's still a print preview. File, print preview. Now, why? That's my question, because I mean, I guess there's some stuff that's different in the print preview than there is in the print view. But the reason I think this exists is because this used to be the only way to see this. And now there's a view that'll show you that, but they didn't take it away because there'd be people who complain if they don't have a print preview anymore. And there are some things that are slightly different. If they were starting from scratch, they would probably have a print view that was the same as the print preview. But in this case, well, I can't edit this because it's the preview, but I can edit this because it's the print view. Okay, whatever. Some other views that are available. Reading layout. So this, I suppose, would be if you're proofreading it or trying to read it out. This is the first time I've ever seen this view, so do you have a suggestion for...
No, they just put this in recently to make it... It's explaining it to make it feel like you're reading a book.
Oh, okay. Because, yeah, everybody wants to read a book on a screen.
Yeah.
But I suppose if you had a tablet and you were reading a book this way, this would be... You know, and it gives you the total number of screens that you're going to be going through, and presumably there's some way to bookmark where you are or whatever, I don't know. But anyway, that's one. Web layout. I recommend you not use this because do not use Microsoft Word to build web pages. As somebody who builds web pages for a living, the web pages that Microsoft Word builds are awful because they aren't really... The code that they generate in order to make the web page is atrocious. And it also doesn't display consistently across different people's machines. If you have an old machine, if you have a Mac, if you have some other weird device, if you use a different browser like Firefox that I'm using on here, what Word generates will not necessarily look consistent between them. There are other tools that are better for building web pages. I mean, quick and dirty, yeah, if you really want to do a web page this way, you can. I'd actually rather you print a PDF and put it on the website most of the time because you're making a Word document. It's a word processor. It is not a web page editor. And I wish they'd never tried to make it one. But what this does let you do is, for example, you can open a web page in Word and then use that as the basis for a document. So you can actually go, I can go open, see if this works right out of here. Don't mind. Yeah. So, well, you can see what it did with my web page, but it actually opened my web page as a document with all the stuff in it. It doesn't have the proper layout to it. But
so could you edit that now?
I can edit that, and then I can go File, Save As, Desktop, and I would say Pen Machine. In fact, I could even save it as a Word document, penmachine.doc, and then it says some of the stuff's not going to work properly, and I say that's fine. Now, on the desktop, I have this document, which is now my web page, but it's a Word document. So that's the one useful thing you can do with this, is you can actually open a web page and ideally strip out a bunch of the other stuff and just take the text that you wanted, rather than having to copy and paste it off the website. You can get some of this here. Now, as you can see, it's kind of dog's breakfast, but some of it works okay. It's not something I recommend doing very much, but this is useful for some things, and especially very basic web pages that you want to turn into a Word document or a PDF or something else. That's useful for that, but that's about all I've ever thought of useful for. And are there any other... Oh, outline. This is useful. There are better dedicated outline tools available, but if you like to construct the outline of your document before you actually write it, this is actually a useful way to do it. And the other thing it lets you do is if you close, you can double click on these various elements and you can actually move different sections around really easily. So if you want to reorganize your document, the outline view is quite handy for that. Now it's gotten really confused. So you can see this is the print layout. But I actually moved this into a different place when I did that. So that's kind of neat. So these are a useful thing. But generally, for the most part, you're working in print layout or normal or outline. Reading layout, web layout, not so useful. If you're on Mac, there's actually a view called Notebook View. which actually looks like lined paper. And it's designed for very quickly taking notes and sort of like you would do in class. And in fact, on Windows, they have a separate program called OneNote. Does anybody use that? It's actually designed for tablet PCs where you can actually write right on the screen and it'll interpret stuff. It's a similar thing. So on the Mac, there's yet another view, which is like, sort of like OneNote is on Windows. And it's useful for actually sitting down and taking notes. And in fact, I'm using it on the MacBook here. It has a, on the Mac, the notebook view lets you record audio. So I'm actually recording my audio in Word, and then I will export it to put it on the website later. So that's kind of a neat thing you can do, and that's a different view that's only on the Mac version and is slightly different. So we're at 10:25. Let me see if there's anything else I'm going to cover before 10:30 here. Paste special. I'm going to show you that now. I was going to show it to you later, but I love this so much. Okay, so you get your dog's breakfast document here like this. This is actually a perfect example of a really nasty document. Okay, so you get a document like this, and somebody says, can you edit this up for me? And you go, oh, my God. It is just, you know, it's... This is a bad example because it's taken from a web page, but say they just give you one of these ones where they've applied all sorts of different formatting, and there's no style, and you try and do stuff, and the numbering goes all weird and everything else, and you just go, oh, my God, forget it. Well, what I do is I go, edit, select all, and I copy it. And then I create a new document. And I'm going to go back to... Actually, let's zoom this. To TextWave. Okay. And then what I do is, this is my favorite thing. When I discovered this, I almost cried. You do paste special. And what it gives you a little menu. It's saying, what do you want me to paste? Do you want me to paste this... You can actually paste one document inside another. I don't know when that would ever be good. Formatted text, picture, HTML, all sorts of stuff. This is the one, unformatted text. So edit, paste special, unformatted text. And there we go. So what I've done there is it's got a whole bunch of stuff, but this is just the text. It doesn't have any styles. It doesn't have any formatting. It doesn't have any italics. All it did is it pasted the plain old text for document that I copied into a... what's the thing that actually lets me zoom? There we go. So... So if you look at this, now it's just plain text. It's still a mess, but now none of that formatting weirdness is there, and I can just start over. And I use this all the time. So if I get a document, or if I'm copying out of a web page, or if I'm copying out of another document, just a single paragraph, and I'm pasting it in somewhere in my document, I use edit, paste special, unformatted text, and then it takes on the formatting of whatever I'm pasting it into. So if you get some paragraph that's... Because typically, if you copy and paste from a website, usually it tries to match whatever wacky fonts on the website when you paste it into Word, which is not what you want. If you paste special and paste unformatted, it just takes the text and dumps it in there, and then it takes on the formatting or whatever you got, and then you can fix it up after that. So in this case, I've done it for an entire document. That's an extreme case, but it's great even for just little chunks of text. Even just, you know, three words, or if you're, you know, you've copied somebody's name out of an email message because it's a very long and complicated name and you don't want to have to retype it, or even their email address, and then when you paste it like this into Word, it won't bring all that formatting from the email with it. Very useful. I use this all the time. And I don't know why it's not better known, because among editors, that's a fabulous thing. So I'm going to leave it at that for right now. We're going to take a break for 20 minutes. So we will come back at 2:15. And apparently they have coffee and stuff for us downstairs. So if we go in the elevator and down to the whatever it was. Did she say third floor? Okay. So apparently if we go to the third floor, which is another place I'm not sure I've ever been, and then go to the right, once we get out of the elevator, there will be stuff there for us. If you want to leave your stuff here, that's fine. I have the key, so the door will lock. Is anybody going to stay in here? Good, because this is not a place you want to stay unless you have. And as always, if you have questions, you can ask them to me now, but wait till we come back, because then everybody can hear them. Unless you have questions about something that's not this. And we'll move on. Our next section will be, just to warn you, that's back at our agenda here. Quick and dirty editing tips. So more of this, I was going to put that paste special tip in the next section, so we'll do more of that sort of stuff next.
This audio is part of the Pen Machine podcast at podcast.penmachine.com, also listed at Blueberry, BLUBRRY.com.
Okay. All right, so I figured out that language thing that I couldn't figure out before. I was just completely blind to the menu. If you look up on the tools menu, there's a menu called language, reasonably enough, and you can say set language. So in this case, that paragraph is set for U.S. English, but you can choose any number of Cherokee, Canadian English, Congo French, all sorts of options, or do not check spelling or grammar. So you might come across this. I've come across this occasionally where the spell check just doesn't check the spelling, and that's why, because that do not check spelling or grammar was set for that section. So if you select all and say set it all to Canadian English or U.S. English or whatever, then that gets out of the way. This detect language automatically is interesting. It can try to figure out which language that is.
That's when it's trying to be really smart.
Yeah. So I don't know what happens if you stick a bunch of German words in an English sentence, what it would do. Or, you know, traditional Chinese characters in English sentence. I don't know what it would do. So anyway, so that's that issue. Figured that out during my lunch break. Once I was well fed, my brain worked a little better. So we have two options right now as to how we're going to approach this. Again, the agenda was very loose. So I can either give you time now to work on this quick and dirty edit thing, or we can talk about the track changes and stuff first and do that later. What would you prefer?
Let's carry on with track.
Carry on with track changes? Does that sound good? Sounds good to me. All righty then. So, as I explained before the break, track changes is really two separate things. There's track changes and there's display changes, and they are completely independent of one another. So if you go to Tools and say Track Changes, you get this toolbar here. And it enables you to control the both aspects of this this process. So if you what you have here is... Okay. This button lets you turn track changes on or off. So if it's off, it's like that. If it's on, it's like that. Depending on which version of Word you have, you may see different things. The Mac version, the toolbar looks a little bit different. The older versions of Word, you might have tools, track changes, and then some submenu items, activate, deactivate, show, hide. They're sort of set there rather than on a toolbar. And you also can activate this reviewing pane here. It shows you what the changes are. But if you turn this on, by default, what you get is this over here. This is which view you get. So by default, you get the red bloodbath view, which is the... Here is the... Oops. Is the new stuff. So, by default, you this. Where's the traction? So, by default, in the current version of Word, what you get is this. So if you delete something, it used to be that it showed a line through it. And it was actually within the body of the text. Now it puts it over here at the side and says this is what you deleted here. Still not particularly elegant. If you do a lot of editing, it can turn to a real mess. So what I recommend you do, if you need to use this, is use Final. Because what that does is that just lets you do your usual stuff. You can say, okay, delete that, grab this, move it over here, down there, and so on and so on. You can type some new things. Okay, stuff like that. So you just behave here as you would normally, but this little thing is still turned on. It's still tracking your changes, it's just not showing them. So if you go back to final showing markup, you can see what I did there. Stuff has been deleted, stuff has been inserted, shows you what's going on over there. So you can take a look at what's happening, but when you're editing, you can actually do it in such a way that you don't have to watch it as it's going on. This is particularly useful if you're exchanging documents with people and a whole bunch of people have made edits and all you want to see is what it looks like now. And then when you, if you get to something and say, well, what happened there? That sentence totally changed meaning, or I don't know what's going on. You can turn that on and see what's been inserted and deleted and changed and by whom. The other option is you can show original. And in this case, it shows you what's been deleted and only highlights what's been inserted over here. So this shows you what you had before, or you can even just say original. This shows you the pre-edit version. Now, here's one of the confusing parts. You can turn this off, and it still shows you what the edits were. So now it's no longer watching what you edit. And in fact, if you go in and I go in and delete all this. Oh, it is. Oh, it's not actually tracking it. It's deleted. Something got deleted, but it doesn't remember what because it's watching. So I turned the tracking off and kept editing. So you can have the track. Essentially, it only tracks changes when the robot is watching. If you've got it turned on, it'll monitor your changes whether you're showing them or not. And it can show the changes whether you're currently monitoring what you're changing or not. So what that means is, theoretically, you could probably, if you're collaboratively editing with a bunch of people, you could be sneaky and always turn the tracking off when you make your edits so they never knew what you did. That might annoy them, but that's one option. You can selectively turn, or for example, if you're moving a bunch of chunks of the document around but not actually editing them, you might want to turn the tracking off so that you don't end up with deleted here and then inserted over here when it's exactly the same thing, and then people really don't need to look through it again if you just say, well, I moved it. That sort of thing is useful there. Now, when you get a document that's been edited this way with the track changes on, you also have the process for accepting and rejecting what the changes are. Now, you can either go, you know, the one-off way is to go next, next, and at each point you say, so the slow and grinding way is, or if you get a document from somebody and you're just wondering what's changed, you say next, and it takes you to the first change, and you say, oh, that was deleted. Well, you can either say, yes, I'll accept that change, or no, I'll reject that change, and I want it to go back the way it was. And then you go to the next one, you can say, yes, that one is okay. The other option is for you to say, accept all changes in document. So you can just say, okay, they're all fine, and accept them all, and they'll all go in as they were. Or, no, all the changes were bogus, I'm going to go back to the way it was before we get any of this tracking. Now, what happens is when you're tracking changes, the document potentially gets very large because it's tracking all those changes, all the insertions and deletions, and even if they include graphics and charts and movies and whatever else you might have inserted there, if you delete them all but you have track changes on, it still keeps them in the document. It just keeps them as tracked as deleted. So the document could be extremely large even if there's only two words in it if you've had the track changes on the whole time. So that's something to keep in mind. What I often do, what I find as an editor is that, particularly with new clients, they'll say, well, I want to use track changes. And my first response is, okay. Because they're legitimately somewhat paranoid. They want to see what you did so that they can make sure that you didn't change what they meant to say, and just so they can see what you accomplished. What I do is if that's what they want me to do, and this is just a one back and forth, I'm not talking, you know, heavy collaboration with people, is I go to the final view, but I turn the track changes on, I go and make all my edits of whatever sort, and, you know, move stuff around, and do this and do that, and break paragraphs. So, but I would leave it at this final. So, I'd be editing it so that I can't see what's going on there at the time. And so on and so on, and delete, and whatever I do. And then, before I send it to the customer, I do two things. First, I turn this to final showing markup so they can see what I did. So they see the deletions and they see the insertions. And then I save that as Derek edited the markup, for example. Then I go back and I turn off, before I do that, I turn the track changes off. I turn the track changes off so that it's no longer going to, if they type some more stuff, it's not going to introduce more things into this document that I've created for them. Once I've done my edits, I turn the track changes off so that what they get, if they do anything else, it's not going to add on to it. You can choose what you want to do there. The other thing I do is I make sure it's off, and then I say, accept all changes in document. And then final, you don't even have to do that because I've accepted all the changes, and then I save again. Derek edited final. So here's what that gives them. That gives them two copies of the document. They've got the one that's got all the edits in it shown with the track changes with all the red bloodbath and everything else in it. And then they get the other one that's final, complete, finished. No track changes stored in there anymore. It's just the document. And almost every single time they go, great, and they just use it. They never actually do anything with the track changes version. So essentially all I'm really doing is editing the document as I normally would and giving them the final version. And the track changes is only there as evidence that I actually did something.
What would original show you?
Original would show you, that's a good question. Say I have, let's open up the Derek edited markup. So I've got the markup here. If I go, and I've turned that off, original, it actually shows the way it was before I edited it. So you can flip back and forth.
Before you saved it, it remembers what to be.
Yeah, well, that's what track changes is doing. It's tracking everything between the original and the final. So if you send it to them in the original format, even though the tracks are changes, they're going to go, you didn't change anything. So that's why it's worth setting it to that display. But it lets you look at what did the document look like before and what did it look like after, or what did it look like in between with the edits.
Okay.
I don't actually use the original view very much, but what that lets you do is, for example, you want to see, it started off as a 13-page document and now it's an 18-page document. You can see what the two look like and whatever else there.
So the client could then view it in those four different ways as well.
Most people don't know they can do that.
Okay.
Now you do.
When you first open track changes, what's the view that you get usually?
By default, you get the final showing markup. So what it does is it shows you what you've inserted in red, and it shows you what's deleted over on the side. Older versions used to show you what's deleted crossed out, which got really awful because then you couldn't tell what was going on, and something looked like it was 40 pages long when it was really only 10. So this is better. It's still hard to read because of all the color. And the underlining, and especially if you get multiple people working on it and they have different colors and things, it can get really confusing.
How does that work? Just together, if three people are editing a document, how do you know who's making it?
Well, when you install Word, you say, my name is whatever, and my initials are DKM. Usually it asks you for your initials. And so when you get a document like this, if I passed it to you, Word would automatically...
save your profile?
Well, it would automatically say, okay, this first person used red, so now it's going to be you, and you're going to be blue.
Okay.
And the next one's in, I forget what the order is. There's a way to set that in here somewhere. But essentially, it just picks, it knows that there's been somebody, and then somebody else, and somebody else. So everybody will get a different color. And when you start getting into that, it gets really hairy. I've never done substantial collaborative work with a bunch of people doing that. I don't know how well it would work. Personally, when I get into that sort of situation, I tend to prefer using some sort of online tool, like a wiki or something that everybody can edit. It tracks the changes in a different way, in sort of versions. And I prefer that, where you have just different versions of the document that automatically gets stored, which Word doesn't quite... there's ways to do that, too, but it's... the collaboration features in Word are a little bit half-baked. They work, but I find this works best if you're just doing some work for somebody, maybe going back and forth between two people. When you start getting more than that, it starts to get a... I prefer just to work on the document. Now, really, in actuality, if somebody sends me a document that needs substantial editing work, I'd rather just sit down and either do it, you know, sit down and just run through it, or really what I'd like to do is print it out and grab my red pen and, you know, mark up all the stuff that needs marking up, indicate where I'm going to move things. That paper still gives you a lot more flexibility in how you can sort of freeform draw what you want to do, and even just for yourself. So even if they want it in a track changes format, if it's really substantial editing, sometimes what I'll do is print it out and do all my markup first and then make all those changes with the track changes on. But I still have my marked up version, and sometimes I'll send them both. I'll say, here are my notes, you know, a photocopy or a fax or a scan of the notes that I made. Here are the track changes, and here's the final version. And really, most of the time, especially if you're on any kind of deadline, they'll just go, great, the final version's wonderful, I'll use that. Or they might find one thing where they go, well, they'll read through the final version and they'll say, something there's not quite right, and then they can look at the track changes and see what you did. So it makes a good reference. But it's not really the kind of tool that... it's not something I would use regularly if I had the choice, just because it's not that elegant. The interface has improved somewhat, but the fundamental functionality is still the same. And the key thing to remember is that you've got the robot watching what you're doing, and you've got the display showing what you're doing or not, and that you can have either or both of them on or off at any time, and you can have those different ways of displaying things, and that you can approve or reject comments as you go, or all at once, or probably if you do a selection, you can probably do just that selection. Let's see. So that's if all changes shown. I don't know when that's going to show up. Not quite sure what that was. Let's see what that says. Insert comment. Oh, okay, so that's a comment. So what you can also do separately from track changes is, this is another collaborative one. If you highlight a chunk of text or just put insert somewhere and then you click this or insert sort of a comment here or something.
There you go.
Comments. So the same thing. That's the same as this. Then you can actually type a little note here, and when you print it out, you can choose to have the comments printed at the end, for example. So that's another collaborative thing where you can sort of discuss the document within the document. This is, again, most of the time on this sort of thing, I'd rather print it out and just write some notes in the margin or some sticky notes on there and send them, you know, give that to the client. And it gives them a more immediate connection, and they can sort of look at it and go, okay, this, that. The commenting feature, I don't know if I've ever used it with a customer. I know some people do, but I don't find it that useful. And, you know, I'm like the web software guy. I do stuff online if I can. But another program that has commenting features that work reasonably well is Acrobat. If you're working with PDF documents, you can actually append comments and little notes and things all over that. I have used that on occasion. And that's good for an editorial process where you don't actually want the customer or the client or whoever else is working on it to be able to change the document itself very substantially. You just want them to be able to make comments, which you can then incorporate into whatever changes you're going to make. So that works all right, too, if you've got Acrobat, and you all do. But again, you know, more people have Word than I do. The other thing is, you know, in a lot of contexts, you can just set up a convention where you say, you know, you just have a thing where you say, well, if I put three square brackets, this isn't clear. I've done lots of things like that, where you just say, okay, anytime I put three square brackets, that's a comment. And then you can search and replace you know, search for those and cut them out later. The nice thing about that, yeah, you can highlight it with the highlighter tool here. You know, let's just say, okay, that's a note like that. The nice thing about this is that even if you start pasting it into email or another program or it gets saved as plain text or something, these sort of things still go through. Or if you're doing it on some sort of web interface or whatever, these kind of comments still apply. And it's not that hard to search for them and then pull them out. It depends on what kind of stage of editing you're at, too. Now, if you're talking about the text of the document without worrying about the formatting very much, these sort of things, or even the comments and track changes, can work better. If you're getting to the point where you're working with the actual layout within Word and the styles and formatting and stuff like that, this can cause more complication than you want that late stage of the document. And there, it's often really much better to print it out and just say, you know, this font is too small, and circle it, sort of at the proofreading stage, or the nitpicky comment copy editing stage. You can either just do it. Because the other thing is really nitpicky copy editing. You know, if you just need to do the occasional little, you know, exclamation mark or something like that, even if it did show up in track changes as a little red exclamation mark, you might not see it. So if you can circle it on a piece of paper and say, you know, put an exclamation mark here, that's often clearer. And then you have your printed notes to go back to later when you're proofreading to make sure that those changes got made. So often, this, people are going to make you use this, but my recommendations are actually to sort of work around it. Edit with the track changes on, but not displaying it so that you can edit as you normally would. Display it only for them, and also send them a version where all the changes have been accepted, and then they can just go, great, or, you know, let's fix this up a little bit. So sort of don't use it as your editing environment, because I don't think it really works very well there. Maybe it does for you, but it certainly doesn't for me. So I don't recommend doing that. Any other questions about the track changes? Have I explained what it's doing sufficiently that you sort of get it?
Just to clarify, they only see the red changes when you save it to show changes.
Well,
and then email them that document.
What it is that... I'm not entirely sure that's true. I think so. As far as I understand it, and I may be wrong here, but I think I am. When you have changes tracked in a document, so when you have at some point turned track changes on, and whether or not you turned them off again, those changes are tracked within the document. So when you send that document to somebody, they have, you know, I think when you send it, it will go in whatever view that you have chosen when you save it, I think. But they can change it to whatever other view. So if you set it so that the changes are tracked but you're not displaying them, they can choose to see them. Or if you send it to them like this, they can choose not to see them. They can change them anyway, although most people don't know they can. So all that is saved in the document. The only way you can prevent all that from showing up is if you accept all the changes and then resave the document.
Right.
So that what they get doesn't have any of the tracking information stored in it. So when you do that, when you accept the changes and resave the document, it purges out all the stuff that was in that tracking information, and it's now gone. So all the deletions and insertions and things that are in the background, when you accept the changes, or when you reject them for that matter, all that tracking information goes away for the things you accepted or rejected. If you do them all, they're all gone, and it's just like a document where you've never tracked anything.
But you'd still have them in the original document?
Well,
not in
if you just do file save after you've accepted all the changes, then they're all gone.
Yeah.
But if you keep an original version with the track changes, then all the tracking stays there. So essentially it's just a matter of... So again, in a way, there's almost the three levels here. There's the robot watching. Am I tracking changes right now or not? Am I displaying changes right now or not? And are the changes still in the document or not? Or are some of them in and some of them not? I mean, if you've accepted some and not accepted others and left some without doing anything, then some of them are there and some of them aren't. But so all that stuff is inside the document, and the safest way to get the final version. The problem you run into is if you do track changes and you just turn the display off but you don't turn the tracking off and then send it to somebody, whatever else they do gets tracked, and then if you turn the viewing on again, you get this huge red bloodbath of even more stuff you weren't expecting. So I always recommend turning the tracking off, even if you're displaying, even if you're sending it to somebody to display it, just so, unless they want to be part of the tracking exchange process back and forth. And often when you're dealing with customers, even when they say they want the track changes, you're going to have to educate them about what's going on here so that they understand what they're doing. And they may choose not to, and they just, whatever, I'll just write my stuff and they'll do whatever it does. But it's good if they understand this sort of stuff as well, so that they know what they're doing and what they're not doing and what happens when they turn it on and off and stuff like that. It's just, I mean, it's like, you know, think of it like the robot or the camera. You can turn the camera on and off, and you, I haven't quite got a metaphor for the display section that works quite as well as that. It's like, even after the camera's off, you still have the tape that it made of what you did. And you can choose to erase that tape or not, I guess. That's sort of not a bad thing. Yes?
I've just been playing around with it, and I reject all the changes, the highlighting doesn't.
The highlighting, actually, these things here, the highlighting and the comments,
mm-hmm.
They are actually, they have nothing to do with track changes at all. Comments are a separate thing. So comments are a separate feature, different from tracking changes. Highlighting, all that is putting color over it.
Yeah.
It's not. It's just coloring the text, basically.
Yeah.
It has no relation to the track changes. So when you accept and reject changes, it has nothing to do with this. What you can do is you can just say, no highlighting, and then it goes away. Or you could, I don't know, you might be able to search for anything that's got highlighting in it. What I recommend is generally that if you, or the other thing you can do is you can actually select the entire document and say, no highlighting, and then it'll just delete all the highlighting in the whole document. Or, you know, if you're using it for this purpose, all you really need to do is just delete that paragraph and then the highlighting goes away as well. It's just there for exactly as it would be in a paper document. It's just to highlight something, and it has no... Word doesn't ascribe any meaning to that at all. You can choose what color you want to highlight, you can do whatever else. It doesn't have it. Word, unlike the track changes, it doesn't say that this means that this is important or that it's deleted or inserted or a comment or anything. It just says it's yellow. Just like if you made it bold, it doesn't really care why it's bold. It's just, it is, and it's only there for visual representation. So, the next thing I want to move on to, what are we at? Oh, sorry, yeah.
Me and I have also the old version of this because my desktop.
Yeah.
And when I'm trying to collapse it, instead of make a paragraph break for the relation to B1,
yeah.
And I'm trying to collapse it, when I'm trying to say it will not clean up that white space, so I'm just taking away XXX, which looks terrible.
It won't clean up the white space.
It will not delete that white space.
Well, it actually is deleting it. It's just
not showing it.
It's not showing it because it can't put a strikeout in a space. So essentially, if you displayed it in such a way that you don't see the changes, that white space will be gone.
Okay.
So that's why I recommend working in the mode where it's not displaying it, because you'll see what it's actually doing. And then when you display the changes again, it'll look like it undid that, but it didn't. So it is really doing it. It's just not showing you that it deleted it very effectively, which is one reason why they've gone to this kind of model. Because then if you delete, if you have the track changes on, and you delete that, it does show you what it is. It just says that it deleted a paragraph mark, which is a lot clearer than it used to be. And there's a way to set the new versions of Word so that it has the annoying... display that you used to have. That's what we saw in the help there, Word 2000 style. I don't know why you do that, but if you were used to it, well, there you go. You could. So that's another thing, is that often if you're going, even now, and if you're going in track changes mode, like, for example, if you actually have some text that you've made red on purpose, you're not going to know whether it's red or whether it's inserted. Why you'd want to put red in there, I don't know, but maybe you would. And again, there could be a few other things that when the track changes is on and you're displaying everything, it's not going to show things exactly the way they finally will be. However, there's one other thing that is useful. Well, print preview even includes that, so I guess we've got it set to include that in the printout. So there's ways to deal with that, too. So what I want to show you now, before we get to the actual practice bit, is a whole bunch of the kind of settings you can change to make working with Word a little bit less annoying. Let's sit down here because it's a little easier to do. Most of them, again, Word isn't necessarily super friendly with this. Most of them are in Tools Options, or if you're on the Mac, it would be under the Word menu Preference. And you get this massive box with all these tabs and blah-de-blah-de, you know, just tons and tons of stuff. But let's look at some of the stuff here. You can choose to have all sorts of things show up or not or whatever else. This is the one that I was showing before, the formatting marks. This is a really useful one. I tend to leave it like this. Paragraph marks on, nothing else on. I don't want to see all the spaces in the document. I don't want to tab characters. Yeah, I could see maybe seeing tab characters. Optional hyphens, no. Optional breaks. So that would be places where you had... you can, when you're typing, actually say, if this word is going to be hyphenated, this is where I want it to happen. I think it's like alt hyphen or something. And it can show you whether those are there or not, all that sort of thing. Okay, various other ones here. So in that case, what I did there was I changed it. Now I've no longer got the spaces between, but I've got the... Actually, let me go back to a normal document that doesn't have all the track changes and stuff. So let's grab this one. Okay, so Tools, Options. So my recommendation is turn on the paragraph marks, turn off the rest of it, maybe use the tab characters, and then you'll see, you know, you'll see these line endings, you'll see the paragraphs. If you put a tab in, oh no, that's not what I wanted. Being too smart again. So if I have a tab here, it shows you with these arrows that there are things in there. And that can be useful because maybe you don't want tabs, or maybe you do. So that's a good thing to display. There's actually some other options in here that... draft font. Yeah, I think that's only a normal view. So here. So what I did there... Sorry, just go back. In here... This is what it would normally look like in normal view when you see whatever fonts you've chosen, and they could be whatever. Let's say we'll pick something here. Styles and formatting. And we'll make this 5, whatever. Okay, now if I'm in normal view and I go to Tools, Options, Draft Font, you can choose to make the whole thing a single size font, just like an old kind of typewriter, except it still does the boldface and things. This is interesting because it's actually a very good way when you're proofreading something on screen. If you change it to this draft font view, you're looking at it in a totally different context than what you've been looking at it for the past 18 days while you've been editing this document, and you can actually see things that you didn't notice before because it's now in a different font and you don't have all the formatting and size issues there. So I found that actually useful when you're at the... Or when you're in the pure writing phase where you don't want any of the fancy formatting to appear. So you can choose any font here you want. The default is Courier because that's sort of, you know, old school. But you could choose whatever, Gaudi old style. And then everything will look like that. And then when you change it back, turn draft font off, it goes back to whatever the real formatting is. So that's sort of interesting. I don't know who came up with that idea. It's not something that ever would have occurred to me. So there's other stuff here too. Here's another funky one. Blue background, white text. So again, this is very useful for if your eyes are tired, if you want to proofread, if you just want to go back to the days of Word 5.0 for DOS, if any of you ever did that, where it was white on blue, and Courier. So that some people work that. this, oh yeah, here we go. Turn off the animation, turn off the sound. It's already off here. All the bleeps and bloops and swooshes and everything else. Turn that off. Confirm conversion and open. That's probably if you're opening an old version, old Word file. Mails attachment. This is where you can set how many files show up over here. So when you have a file, how many files of your recent files show up here, you can tell it to have a whole bunch in there, which is useful. Help for WordPerfect users. Remember that? Navigation keys for WordPerfect users. Background open of web pages. I don't know. I'd leave that off. Measurement units. You can choose to go centimeters, millimeters, points, picas, depending. Allow starting and reading layout. Okay, whatever. Yeah, this is for Asian fonts. I'm not worried about that. Now, there's a bunch of other ones here. Web options. I don't recommend using Word for either web pages or email. First of all, because I don't like HTML email anyway. And also, it seems kind of clunky to use Microsoft Word to write your emails when they're usually supposed to be relatively simple documents. So I don't recommend doing any of that stuff. But it's there. Now, there's other stuff here. Okay. Now, here, it gives you options. When you paste a picture in, what do you want to happen to it by default? You can always change it. So in this case, it goes in as a character, but you can have it go into one of those wacky layers by default if you want. When selecting, automatically select entire word. This is something that's sometimes annoying. Like, if I do this, and I get to... Or if I click, double-click there, it gets the whole word, gets the space after the word. Sometimes I don't want it to do that. So if you find that you're constantly annoyed that it's grabbing characters at the end of the word that you don't want, like say you're going, okay, I'm here, and I'm going, and you notice that when I got here, I started at Monstro. When I get to the next word, it selects the whole rest of monstrosities. I might not want that. I'm an editor. I selected that on purpose. I don't want you to grab the whole rest of the word. Well, if you don't want it to do that, you can tell it, no, don't do that. So when selecting, automatically select entire word, no. Prompt to upstyle. Okay, this is something I recommend you turn on. Remember when we were saying auto update a style? So when you're if you have one of those styles that has accidentally gotten set so that when you make changes to something that's in that style, it wants to change all the rest of the things in the whole document, this will ask you if that's what you want to do. And if you see that, you can go, oh, no, I don't want to do that. So I recommend leaving that on. Keep track of formatting. I'm not sure what that is. That might be track changes, but I don't know. Okay, enable click and type. This is where you can just open a document. Let's see what click and type is. You go file, new, blank document. I'll start down here. Oh, it's going to be in print layout. So if you're in print layout, I start down there and I go hello. All I did there was click and start typing. So it automatically put a whole bunch of returns in there and a tab to get me started. Personally, that's it being too smart and it annoys the heck out of me. So I turn that off. But that's designed for people who just want to start. Again, people who don't do this for a living, it's for them to just get going and get it starting to do roughly what it thinks they want right away. I turn that off. And then again, that sets a default paragraph style. IME options, I don't have a clue what that is, so I'm not even going to go there. You've got a bunch of options in printing that can be useful. Draft output, that gives you that same kind of draft font look where it's printing out in a different font, very plain. Also good for proofreading. If you're just printing it out and you just want to look at the text without a lot of formatting. Update fields and links. So if you want, when you print, it can update all your cross-references, your table of contents, your headers and footers, your various links, all that stuff. You can have it do that before you print automatically if you want to turn those on. If not, just whatever. These I wouldn't worry about too much. Include with document properties. You can turn that off. Hidden text, drawing objects, background colors, So if you email something and you got this off, theoretically, although I wouldn't bet on it, those properties I showed you, the author and all that stuff, might not go with it. I think it does. I don't know exactly how that works. And then there's a bunch of other options there. Here's the save tab. Always create backup copy. This is interesting. This is where when you save, it will save more than one copy, and it'll save the last most recent one you did and then whatever your current one is. That's sort of a nice thing if you often run into trouble with that sort of stuff. So embed TrueType fonts. If you're using wacky fonts that you don't expect other people to have, you can use this feature to include them in the document. Doesn't mean they'll be able to use it in other documents, but at least they'll see things better. So if I'd done that on this original document where we had those weird blocky characters that were in Bell Gothic bold or something, it would have actually come through properly. That's kind of nice. It doesn't work for PostScript fonts, which are another type of font that might not work. Here's the autosave, save auto recover info. So every 10 minutes, I actually recommend putting that at 5 or 3, because it used to be that computers were slow enough that this would actually be really annoying because it would be saving and you'd be sitting there waiting or whatever. Now it sort of happens in the background unless the document's really large. So if you set that low, that means that if something crashes, you'll be able to run Word again and get back to where you were no more than 5 minutes ago. So that's good. Smart tags, I don't know. I'd actually turn this off because I'm not even sure what they are. So prompt for document properties, prompt save normal template. Here's something you see a bit. Sometimes if you turn this on and you've made some adjustments and you save the file, it says, do you want to save normal? And what that means is that you've made changes to this document that somehow could affect the generic settings in the normal.doc. Usually say no. I turn that option on and I say no. I want the normal template to be the way I left it. I don't want it to get modified. Because the thing that it does is when that happens, it doesn't tell you what has changed. It just says, the normal.template has changed. Do you want to save it? And I go, well, I don't know what I did. You know, I made some changes in this document. I don't want all my headings from now to perpetuity to be that huge Gilson's extra bold outline thing that I did in that other document, and maybe that's what will happen. And I think because this is off by default, that's how you get some of these documents that you receive that have just the weirdest, you know, you set up a heading or something that wasn't in the document and it comes out in this weird font, weird size, strange margins, whatever else, because somehow that happened because 2 years ago they made some change that ended up affecting this normal template and nobody really knows how or why, but it's persisted through every document they made ever since. So I recommend prompting and then saying no when it asks. And here's an interesting thing. Default format. Save Word files as Word document. So you can set it to save by default as something else. For example, RTF. Yeah, so that's a format that's got that's fairly well established. It sometimes makes bigger files than the Word document format. It doesn't support all the weird things you can do inside Word. But pretty much anybody can read that because there are any word processor can read and write RTF. And Microsoft actually created the format. It's just kind of sat there and they've done some stuff in the doc format that you can't do in RTF. But if you're... Sorry?
Can Mac read it
now? Oh, yeah. Macs, in fact, the built-in text editor on Macs by default uses RTF. So rich text format is actually good if you're mostly dealing with documents that don't have a lot of heavy layout and formatting of that sort and are mostly just, you know, text with headings and whatever else. You can use RTF and you can even set it as your default format and then you can be pretty sure that anybody will be able to read it. I don't know if all the track changes stuff go through here. Probably not. Maybe that's a good thing. So RTF is not a bad thing to make your default if you want, or at least to save before you send it to people. You can also use Word document and then say disable any features introduced after, you know, Word 6 in 1995. So if you know that the person that you're working with has an older version of Word, you can make sure that you're saving in a format that they will be able to read and write without any trouble. Chances are they'll be able to open it anyway, but they might have some strangeness if you're using a newer version or if they're using a newer version than you are.
Does that just apply to the document you're working on or any document?
Well, in this case, it would apply to every document. So you would say that in this, if you set this, it would be every document I create, unless I say differently, is going to be a Word document, a Word 6 document, or an RTF document, or something else. So, for example, if you're working with the same people or in an office all the time, or you just, or your other computer has an older version of Word and you want to be able to go back and forth, your laptop's got one and the other one's got another, you can do this. Now, this is not an issue because since, I think it's since Word 2000, the Word file format hasn't changed. So if you have Word 2000 on one machine, Word 2003, and Word 2004 for Mac, and Word 10 for Mac, and even Word 98, like, might even be the same on Mac, you can just move files willy-nilly back and forth because the file format is the same, except for a few wacky things like the voice recording that I'm doing here. But so generally, any, you know, again, this is real legacy stuff. This is saying if somebody has a version of Word from 1997, you know, so 9 years ago, if they're still using a 9-year-old version of Word, or something else that can read and write that 9-year-old version, or if they're using an 11-year-old version of Word, you can make sure that you're compatible with them. So that's good. You can either do it here, or when you save the document, you go File, Save As, and you get the same kind of choices down here. You can say Word 97, or you can say Word 67, or Works, sorry, Word 97. You know, you can say that stuff when you save an individual document. Yeah, that's just this document. But if you want to do it more generally, you can do it in the options. Security. So you can set a password on a document. I mean, it's not, you know, it's not so secure that CSIS couldn't get at it, but it means that just generally, if somebody gets a hold of that document and tries to open it, they won't actually be able to read or write or do anything with it until they put this password in. But don't forget the password. And again, there's a difference. There's a password to open and there's a password to modify. So you can set it so people can read it, but they can't change it unless they have a password. So that's not bad. It is cryptographic, so that's interesting. So if you do the password, what it does is it actually digitally scrambles the contents of the document unless you have the password. So it is actually pretty difficult for anybody to get at the data, even with another tool, which is kind of cool. Or read-only recommended. You can do a bunch of stuff like that.
So in that respect, you don't need a PDF file. You can modify this so that they can't.
That's true. Yeah, you can do that. The difficulty there is you have to make sure that they have a version of Word or whatever that understands that and can decode it.
Okay.
So people almost never do this. I've encountered Excel spreadsheets that have had passwords on them, but I've never encountered a Word document that doesn't. So it's not a bad idea. That doesn't guarantee that all your formatting is going to come out exactly right, but it's kind of neat. Here's the good one. Remove personal information from file properties on save. I say turn that on all the time, unless you want to have that information in there. So, you know, it will still have stuff like the title of the document, but it won't have your name and all that other stuff. So where I removed it manually before, this just prevents it from going in the first place. Here's another good one. Warn before printing, saving, or sending a file that contains track changes or comments. So in this case, if you inserted comments or track changes, and even if you're not displaying them, it will tell you that they're in there before you print it or before you save it or send it to somebody. So that's useful because then you can, you know, if you've forgotten that you turned track changes on 3 weeks ago, it'll tell you. This I'm not really sure about. Okay. The macro security thing. By default, this is pretty good. One of the issues that came about, I guess probably about Word 95, Word 97, is that Microsoft started building in a little programming language into Office where you could do some automated functions. Like I said before, if you're skilled enough, you could figure out how to automate some of these things you do over time. But of course, when you put in a programming language, that opens it up for people to write nasty programs that do things you don't want. So there were, and they're not very common anymore, but they do exist sometimes. There were ways where you could get a Word document that basically had a virus inside it. And it would actually work in some way or another on Windows and Mac because it was a compatible language in both things. And it could do stuff to Word, at least, and potentially to stuff on the rest of your system. These settings let you determine whether you want to do that. And what it does is it usually pops up a little dialog box saying, this document has some macros in it. Do you want to enable them or not or whatever? Most documents that you edit don't require this sort of thing, but you can create some complex sort of semi-programmatic stuff in there where there are forms to fill out and things that you can do that automatically calculate things and other stuff. And some of those would be in here. I recommend generally turning them off. In fact, I'd be happy to crank this up to very high and just leave it at that. I'll ignore the Asian typography because I don't know anything about it. File locations. This is a useful thing for you to say, you know, where do I store things by default? Where are the templates? In fact, that's probably where the normal is in Microsoft templates. And you can change where those go. You can say, when I create a new document, where would it go by default? So you don't have to navigate to wherever you want to put it every single time you save a document. So those are useful. Japanese, fine. I'll learn more about that. Okay, let's get some of your spelling and grammar. Check spelling as you type. This is good. Squiggly red underlines when a word is misspelled. I like that. Grammar. Check grammar as you type. No! The grammar checker is awful. It doesn't really understand any kind of grammar. It understands C-spot run, but it often identifies with the squiggly green underline things that are grammatically perfectly fine. It just doesn't understand them. And the suggestions it makes to correct them are often laughable. So I turn grammar checking off entirely, and I never use the feature because I never find it even remotely useful. It also doesn't seem to have changed much in about 11 or 12 years. Even though computers are much faster now, I just say, well, this is one of the areas where there probably would have been some innovation here if Microsoft Word wasn't the 800-pound gorilla of the market. Somebody might have figured out some tools that do this better. And there used to be separate grammar checkers that you could buy, but that whole market kind of died out, and now this is what's there, and it's not very good, and Microsoft doesn't really have any incentive to improve it, because people like me never use it anyway. So here, it even has grammar and style, and so I just don't need it. So you can do a bunch of other stuff here. Ignore words in uppercase, ignore words with numbers, you know, so Liam123 at whatever, ignore internet and file addresses so it's not going to try and spell check your email address, for example. You can set up a bunch of separate custom dictionaries if you want. One of the things I found, this is a useful one, sometimes you'll find that you have a document and you can't add custom words to the dictionary. You know, so you find a word that's misspelled like this and you want to add it to the dictionary, but this is grayed out. It won't let you add a new word. And you're like, why not? I want to add the new word. Well, usually what that is this custom dictionary thing, and there's nothing here. So you can just say, well, add a new custom dictionary. And you create a file and call it, you know, Derek. And then it's in the list. And then you'll be able to add new words to it. So sometimes that's all it is. You just don't have a custom dictionary set up. And when you do, then you can start adding words to it. So, again, turn off check grammar. It's bad, bad evil. Here's where you can set all the things about how track changes work. What colors it pick, what sort of preferences it uses, do you want to use the balloons, do you want to... You can play around with this. It's just... This is where you can get it back to that awful way it used to be, if you really want. And what colors different people are... what the deletions look like, what formatting are. So, and this you could even say show lines connecting to the text. So in this case, if you don't want those lines going out to where... So if you want to work with the track changes on and displayed, you can tweak this a bit so that it's less annoying than it would be otherwise. Here's where you can put in, if you do want that property stuff to be there, you can put in something that's not going to be so incriminating or personal. You could just say, you know, whatever editing service rather than your personal name. Or you could delete this entirely and then it will never put anything in there. And compatibility, this gives you really fine-grained control over the history of Word, basically. You can say, I want this version of Word to behave sort of, but not exactly like the way Word 5.0 for Mac did in 1992, as far as whether it allows you to do certain things or not, or this or that. If you're just completely, you know, combine table borders like Word 5.0 is for the Macintosh. Who does that? I don't know. basically, back then, they didn't have, the tables weren't sophisticated enough that you could have different kinds of borders in different places, and all the border edges had to be the same. And if you want it to be like that now, you can do that. And, you know, here, there's a huge, I mean, look at the list. It's just like, use Word 2002 table style rules. Use Word 97 line breaking rules for Asian text.
A lot of people with a lot of personal favorites.
Yeah, and you know, this is the breadcrumb trail showing you why Word is such a monster. That there are people who care. Somebody in the world turns these on and off in a particular combination of ways. I'm surprised they don't actually have a little way to save this setting as a little file that you can then move to somebody else's computer so you can have it exactly the way you want it. And, you know, and then switch between different setups depending with some automated macro tool. I mean, theoretically you could. You can substitute fonts, which is actually some, you know, like, for example, here, this Bell Gothic Black, it substituted it automatically for some god-awful font that's, like, I don't know why it did that. But I could say that if it's Bell Gothic Black, I really want it to be script NT bold. So that's good if you have missing fonts, that sort of thing. And here, this default will take you back to the way it always was. Now, you'd think that would be all the options you've got. But no! No. There's a whole bunch of other things. One of them is, you know what really annoys me? Is these menus. That you notice that I've been doing this every time. Recent versions of Word for Windows, thankfully not for Mac, which is what I use, gives you these simplified menus by default. These are the things that I think you would like to be able to do. If you really have something else to do, we want you to click again. You know, so I've been going, well, where's that menu option? Oh, it's in the extended version of the menu. So, let's figure out how to turn that off. I right-clicked in sort of blank space in the menu bar here, and I'm going to customize. So, always show full menus. So, you can have it so that after a short delay, that they just pop up. So that's really, you know, so if I were to go, there we go. That's not a very short delay. Doesn't save me much time. But okay, so we'll go to Tools, and, not Tools, here I'm right-clicking on there and going Customize. And so, always show full menus. Show standard formatting toolbars on two rows. Sure, why not? Large icons. Yeah, okay. List font name. Whoa, that's huge. Wow. Okay, I guess if you had a really big monitor, that might be good. Menu animations. Random? Why would it be like, who cares if you can set this? But somebody does. Do I really, you know, what I want, I don't want to decide which menu animation I want. I want somebody at Microsoft to do some research and say, this menu animation, if we're going to have any at all, is the most effective for helping people understand what the menu is doing. And we're going to use that one. And that's the choice. That's what it's going to be. Maybe you can turn it off, but it's off or on. I want the random menu animation so that every time I open a menu, it does it in a slightly different way. See? So... okay, I don't know what it's doing now. So yeah, that one sort of slid down. One just popped up. Another one kind of zipped off to the side. Do I want that? Who wants random anything? It's crazy. So that one sort of slipped down there. So I'm going to say menu animations. Is there a none option? No? Okay, well, I'll just say system default then. And then this is where, actually, this can be useful. You can customize the keyboard, so you can say which key applies to which menu command. On the Mac, it's slightly different. The preferences are in a different place. You can actually set some system-wide. Anyway, if you want to get into that, you can get into that. Commands, you can actually... you can customize all the menus, all the toolbars, you can move stuff around, put different items with different icons in different places that do different things. You can change what's in each menu so that when somebody else sits down at your computer, they don't know what the hell is going on. And similarly, when you sit down at someone else's computer, you don't know what's going on because you customized yours so heavily that you don't have a clue how anybody else's works anymore. So you can do that if you want. I don't particularly recommend it, but you can. This gives you options on which toolbars you want. You can create your own toolbar. And I think, if I recall correctly, this is actually stored in the normal template. So there's Derek's toolbar. And where is it? Let's go. Oh yeah, there it is. There's my toolbar with nothing on it. So if I right-click on it and customize it, I can then start adding stuff to it. I can say, okay, well, I want this. Let me drag it in here. I want a new blank document. I want the insert menu. How do you do that? Insert column break. And then I can do this up here. So I can have my own totally custom thing that makes new documents, new blank documents, and inserts a column break. And that's my own toolbar. But you could build your own toolbar. You could build one toolbar that has only the things you actually use on it and get rid of all the rest. And that's kind of nice. Or, for example, if you do get into building some of these macros and scripts, you can attach them to a toolbar that you can make come and go. Or if you only use some of the features of track changes, you can customize the track changes bar so it doesn't have the highlighting or this or that, so you can go in and actually you've got to find a blank section. Go ask a question box. Anyway, reviewing. That's called the reviewing bar, by the way, not the track changes bar. It's called the reviewing bar. That's really helpful, isn't it? Anyway, there's a way that you can customize that too. Anyway, that's all well and good. Now, are we done yet? No, we're not. Okay, now, thankfully, my menus now come down at full size every time. There are a bunch of other things you can do here, and most of them begin with auto. Auto format. Options. Okay, you notice that I've got this whole other dialog box. There's another way to get to that. Tools. I think it's tools. Autocorrect options. So autocorrect and auto format are not the same thing, but they use the same preferences dialog box. I don't know what. So autocorrect. Here's a bunch of things that I recommend various things about. Correct to initial capital. That's usually useful, although there are some circumstances where those you don't want it to do that. Capitalize the first letter. All these are automated things that you may or may not want Word to do. Capitalize the names of days. That's usually pretty safe. Correct accidental usage of the caps lock key. That's probably pretty good. Replace text as you type. I usually turn this off. Usually. Or at least I can go down and edit this list. Because things like this are pretty good. But, so for example, see like that automatically turns into a copyright, TM into TM, all that. Three periods turns into an ellipsis character. Did you know those are different? Did you know that when you have three dots, that's actually a separate character that's three dots, it's not three periods in a row? Nobody but a typographer would care, but it is so.
Look at little faces.
Yeah, little faces, arrows, all sorts of things. So you can't, I tend to turn off. Because if I really want one of those characters, I usually use the insert symbol to do it, and I don't want it to automatically do stuff. Now, however, there are other things here that are, some of them are useful and some of them aren't. I'm going to sit down again. Straight quotes with smart quotes. This one depends on what you're doing. If you're formatting the document for print, I recommend you leave this on. So whenever you type quotes, the quotes do the typographer's quotes, curling the correct direction. If you're formatting it for something that's going to go on a website or in an email or in plain text, turn that off. And then what you can do is if you turn this off and then do that search and replace I showed you before where you search for a quote and replace it with a quote, it will turn all the curly quotes into smart quotes, all the smart quotes into straight quotes. And if you turn this on again, it'll do the reverse when you do that search and replace. So this is a useful way to turn it back and forth. There's unfortunately, there's no command that just says make all the quotes straight. I have another program that does that, a text editor. That's great. Just says straighten quotes, and it does it through the whole document. Really nice. Okay, ordinals first with superscript. I hate this because it goes like this. First place. So it turns it into a little superscript like that. I don't actually like that at all. In fact, I don't tend to type first like that. So I turn that off. Similarly, fractions. I don't really want it automatically making the little fraction symbols. Hyphens with dashes. Okay. It's actually pretty smart about this. If you do... Do you know the difference between an M dash and an M dash?
No.
Okay. I'll go into this. It's nothing to do with word direction. But if you are writing... You're writing sort of an interjection kind of dash, or the kind of thing you would use instead of parentheses. That's called an M dash. It's a long dash that has no space around it. So if you look in a properly typeset book, you will see that. So something like this. He said. Dash, and he meant it, dash, that. That's called an M dash, and that's because it's supposed to be the root of an M in the type, or at least in some font. And that's the type of dash that you think of as a dash, where and there's no space around it, and it just goes between characters and goes like that. There's an N dash, which is like this, where you go, one of the uses, there are several others, is when you have a phrase like this, the New York-Chicago train, and you have something in between it, that's actually a shorter dash than this one, but it's not a hyphen. It's called an N dash. And you also use it in something where you have 1916 to 19... And that would be an N dash. If you ever look in a book, you'll see that this is a shorter dash than this one, but it's not a hyphen either. It's longer than a hyphen. And that's called an N dash because it's supposed to be the width of an N. And then there's a hyphen, which is just a hyphen, the kind of thing you do where you have, you know, reorganize words like that, if you use a hyphen. Or then you would put in a hyphen in your name for the end of a paragraph for a hyphen. It's a short little one. Those are all actually different characters. But they're not easy to generate when you're typing, and most people don't know exactly what to do with them. This one automatically does it. So as I showed you before, if I type if I go in here and go dash, 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 and then actually if I go space here, I have to type something else. It automatically turned double hyphens into an M dash. An N dash is a little trickier to generate. Usually the way you do that is, I think, yeah. So if you do a dash with a single dash with spaces around it and then keep typing, it will do an N dash. Sometimes you actually see this instead of that, but with spaces around it. There are typographers who would wring your neck for doing that, but I think it's fine too. But anyway, that's what this option that we were looking at in autocorrect.
Is there always no space after the M dash?
An M dash never has spaces around it.
Okay.
In the only circumstance it would is if it's actually at the end of something.
I can never.
You know where you would where it's representing somebody being interrupted, for example. But there is no normal circumstance where you would have an M dash that has space anywhere near it. Except at the end of the word. So basically think of the longish parts of it as sucking up where the spaces would be. That's why it's so long. N dashes, actually, in this context, they don't. What they're meant to do there is to include everything in both sides of it to make it clear that everything belongs in there. If you're using them, sometimes, for example, you might use them in a list where you say, you have three options here. Green, boldface, green, N dash, and then you have a sentence, or like in a list. Let me just show you what that would look like. Thus, pigs How's For example, like, I mean, ignore the wording because it totally doesn't make sense, but so a list like this is another way that you might use an end dash as a sort of break, you know, the indicator that this is almost like a that this is actually a title to this bullet point. And that's another way to use an end dash rather than a hyphen. Now, again, most people will never notice. However, as you read, I find personally that when these are used correctly, they actually make the reading a little more comfortable, which is, I guess, why they exist. So, you know, the M dashes in particular, when they're used properly as dashes to set things off, they make it clear. If you ever see it where people just use little short little hyphens with spaces around them on either side, it doesn't look quite right. You don't quite get the right impact of that because your brain realizes that it's a little bit confused about what's going on there. So it's worth learning what those are. But anyway, how we got to that was the autocorrect options, which let that happen automatically. So this, I think, is good. Long vowel sounds with dash. I don't even know. I don't know what that's talking about. Bold and italic.
This audio is part of the Pen Machine podcast at podcast.penmachine.com, also listed at blueberry, blubrry.com.
So I wanted to get to a little bit of stuff about web editing. And I'm going to be brief on this because usually I have an hour or something to talk about that alone. But editing for the web is different than editing on paper, for paper, or print, or for email. You may or may not do it inside a word processor. It doesn't really matter. What I want to talk about is not necessarily the tool you might use, but the approach that you'd want to take. And what I'll use as an example there, are there any... There we go. Here's two magazines. How do you know what these magazines are called? Okay. How do you know which part of this is the title?
The big, the whatever, the at the top.
Yeah. Right. Okay, well, there's no law of physics that says that that's where the title of the magazine needs to be. But that has become the convention. One of the reasons is that when it's stacked in a magazine like that, you can figure out what to do. If, for some reason, we had developed a printing technology that things always hung from some sort of hanger, the title would be at the bottom, so you could see it when they're stacked up. But it happens to be there. If we were in a country like China, or somewhere where things are written in Arabic or Hebrew, the magazines would be the other way around, and you would open them a different way and read them from what we would consider back to front. That's the convention there. If I open the front page of these magazines, what am I going to see?
Advertising.
Are you all psychic? How did you know that?
Did you read magazines?
So you're right, there's an ad there. There's an ad there. How far will I have to go before I find something that's not an ad?
Depends how expensive it is.
Yeah. So quite a ways in most of these. And this one...
Is it 5 or 6?
Yeah, 5 or 6. If it's Vogue, it could be 80. So in this one, actually, this one is interesting. It's actually right inside the front cover. I have an ad here, but that is actually part of the table of contents, which is interesting. All those things like having the page numbers at the bottom, except on the ad pages, things like having a table of contents and a masthead and stuff in the front, having usually some sort of feature article right before the back page ad. Those are all conventions that have come about as magazines have evolved over the past, whatever, several hundred years. And what that means is that when you pick up a magazine, if you've never, even if you've never seen that particular magazine before, you know roughly what to do with it. You know where the title is. You know what it's called. You know how to find things in it. You know how to get to a certain page. You know what the page numbers look like. You know what's going to be in the back, what's going to be going on in there. So now a place where that is only recently started to become true is on the internet. When I first started giving these kinds of talks, these sort of standards were not very well established for the web. But now, some things are. If I click here, what's going to happen? You're going to go to the home page. Generally, on most websites, including mine and this one, when you click up there, you go to the home page. The logo or something in the upper left takes you to the beginning, the top. So if you find yourself somewhere way down in the website, you'll end up back at the top, back at the home page if you click there. Now, the reason I picked this one is because this is the English edition of Haaretz, which is a newspaper in Israel. And if you go to the Hebrew edition, the logo's up over here, because Hebrew is written right to left. So the convention doesn't apply everywhere, but here, the reason it's over here is because it's right to left, that's traditionally where you would start reading something. So there, the same thing applies. It just applies in the direction the language is actually written. So these, that sort of convention, another convention is that if something's underlined, and probably blue, but not necessarily, it's a link. If you ever see anything underlined on a web page and it's not a link, you go, hey, come on, click, and it doesn't, and you're really frustrated because the convention has been broken. And what that means is they're starting to become a sort of body of established precedent for no particular reason, a lot of it. I mean, why should links be blue and underlined? That's completely arbitrary. That's just the way they did it when they first started building web browsers that did color. That's come to be what you expect. So if you see something that's different, you might have to think about it a bit. Maybe it doesn't have to be underlined, but it has to be different from the rest of the text in such a way that, you know, so if you look up here, you figure these blue things are probably links too, and they are, because they're the same color as the underlined things. Stuff like that is starting to become a convention. So if you're starting to edit and write for the web, you have to be aware, and make yourself aware of some of these conventions that are establishing themselves. And that's because there's a well-known web usability expert who's somewhat controversial, but he's pretty smart about most things. His name is, I guess it's Jacob Nielsen. He's originally from the Netherlands, I think, but he works in California now. And his law is users spend most of their time on other sites. What that means is if you are involved in building a website or writing something for a website, you'd have to have a pretty good reason to do things in a substantially different way than every other website does, because that's where people spend most of their time. If they're used to links being underlined and underlined things being links, if you change that on your site or you find some other paradigm to do that with, they're going to be confused. And when they're confused, what do people do on the web? They leave. So if you're trying to bring people to a website, for the most part, you should be using some of these conventions. That doesn't restrict, that doesn't mean you can only do things a certain way or you can only write a certain way. It just means that you need to be aware of those things. And just like in any other writing and editing task, awareness of the rules lets you break them when it's appropriate. Now, I'm going to fly through some of these things because we don't have a ton of time. But one of the things I wanted to emphasize is that writing for the web and editing for the web, and particularly editing text that was intended for print for the web, is a pretty substantial task. Because if you look at this screen, although it is extremely large, its resolution is actually pretty low. You can see all the little jaggy bits on the letters and stuff. If I had, you know, a high quality printed map that was this large, the detail on it could be unbelievably deep. You could have print. You know, if you don't need reading glasses, you could have tiny, teeny, tiny print showing. I could have a map of Canada here where you could have probably pretty much any town of any substantial size could be on a map this size, and you could actually see it and read the name of it, as well as rivers, mountain ranges, elevation if you wanted it, all sorts of things like that. You can't actually get that much detail on a computer display that's got this kind of resolution. What that means is when you're reading it at a more normal size, like on a laptop like mine here, or on a screen like this, or typically on your other screen, you're not actually getting as much detail out as you would from paper of the same size. And what that means is you read slower. But what it means is you don't read. You skim. So when people are... when you're editing material for the web, you need to be aware that it needs to be written in a different way. And here is my prime example. A few years ago, I stumbled across this essay called Women in the Web. Interesting essay by a professor at the University of Maryland, I think. Originally written in 2003. It's a pretty interesting essay. It is very academically dense. It's full of jargon, but it's got some interesting points. However, here's what it looks like. Still going. Still going. Now my question for you as I scroll endlessly through this document is, would you read this on the website?
Oh, you're very, very...
with the black text on the...
I would print it.
Yeah, you'd probably print it out because the black text on a green background at a small size with paragraphs that look like that and no links in it and no indications just makes you go, ugh. I mean, most people would just go, okay, never mind. They might get through the first paragraph and the first paragraph is... you know, three pages long practically, and they just bail out. So what I did when I discovered this, I mean, look at this first paragraph. We're like 1.5 paragraphs in the first page of the document on this screen. Now, this is not an atypical way to write a scholarly journal, for example. And I emailed Dr. King, and I asked her politely, this is about the web. Did you write it for the web? And she said, no, I wrote it for an academic journal, and it got republished as is on the website. And I said, do you mind if I kind of tried editing it a bit so that it would work better on the web? And she said, sure, why not? And I had originally intended this to be a fairly ambitious project in multiple stages, and I only got to the first one, but whatever. So what I did is I took the text, copied and pasted it, and I edited it for the web, and this is the same article. Now, I'm going to scroll through it the same way. This is exactly the same words. I didn't change any of her sentences. I didn't change the order of anything. I didn't get rid of any of the jargon stuff I would have liked to. This is what it looks like now. Now, it's still pretty long, but as you can see, what I've done is put some subheadings in, and these I just took. I took some chunk of, you know, the topic sentence of a paragraph and made it a subheading. I turned some of her long, big sort of serial lists into bullet lists. Took some of the quotes and made them set off block quotes, numbered lists. You know, various levels of headings. It's still a difficult read, and I didn't put any links in it, and it's still got a bibliography at the end. But, and the other thing I did is I took those paragraphs that were this long, and I broke them into shorter paragraphs. And even though this is something that your English teacher would probably have frowned upon back in elementary school or high school, it is not unusual, for example, here, to have a paragraph on a website that is one sentence. Two, quite typical. Three, not unusual. Four is actually getting long for a website. If you have a seven-sentence paragraph on the web, you should find a way to break it into more paragraphs than that. Because people need the visual space to figure out what they're looking at when they're going down there. And that's why the subheadings are useful and the lists are useful. And in fact, one of the other things I should have done here and didn't do is something I did over on the side, which is boldface some of the key phrases in the body text, because that provides visual anchors. And people can skim, which is what they do, and go, oh, that's an interesting phrase. Maybe the stuff around it is worth reading. Even if they print this out, it's going to turn out... So I've set it up so that it prints out without all the color and stuff. It even prints out in a way that's a little bit more pleasant to read. It ends up being, what, 17 pages long, but still better than it could have been. So there's an example of, and this is without doing any actual real editing. This is purely formatting and markup, really. Just saying, okay, I'm cutting the paragraphs into chunks, and I'm making subheadings, and I'm making bulleted lists and numbered lists, and I'm just going to try and break this information up in such a way that you can try and digest it in smaller pieces.
What
you,
did she think of your...
I sent it to her, and I didn't actually hear back from her, and it's like two years ago now, so I don't know. She's very busy. She's a professor and whatever. I don't know. I didn't change anything that she said, so presumably she'd be okay with it. But I guess I should check.
Yeah. No, I just was great that yeah. she gave feedback about your...
I think the thing is, I sort of said to her, you know, I've gotten this far, and I had intended to go farther and actually trying to simplify her language somewhat, because when you put something on the web, you don't know who's going to read it. You publish something in an academic journal, you could pretty much rely on, especially, you know, the kind of journal she was publishing this in, you can rely on other professionals in her field of sociology or whatever it is to be the vast majority of the people who are going to read that. So you can get away with some of the sort of insider jargon that they will understand that you won't. Personally, I'm of the opinion that you shouldn't use it anyway, even in an academic context, because often that jargon simply gets in the way of saying what you're saying clearly. And if you can't explain it without the jargon, your idea probably isn't very good. But you get wrapped up in it, especially in academics. You probably know that if you've been in college. You get wrapped up in this, you know, in terminology of semiotics or whatever. You know, there's stuff in here. Let me just pick a random paragraph. Let's see. Actually, these are not so bad. Yeah. These convergences are explicitly commercial, political, and technological in ways that are highly visible right now. That's not a bad sentence. But you get into some other stuff in here where there were words I had no idea what they meant, and I would have clarified that. And I wanted to go in several steps and get it to the point where it was basically a web page that anybody could understand without actually losing the force of the ideas that she was saying here. And that's a difficult project, and you may be, and plus I wasn't doing it for any money, so I sort of gave up on it when I had other things to do. But that's an interesting exercise to try, and it may be something that you're asked to do. And particularly, you know, or the other side of it is what I often get at my work is, you know, here's my bulleted outline or my whatever thing of the 12 things I want to say on our website about this product. Write it up. And it needs to be, you know, a couple pages on the website in that makes sense with some images and other things. And how do you get that all to fit together? Now, I happen to write the code, too, to make it lay out. You may not do that, but it's good to keep that sort of stuff in mind. The other thing that is a good thing for writers and editors is that even though there are tons of places on the web that are full of images and movies and sound and everything else, it's fundamentally a text medium and still is. It's built in HTML, hypertext markup language. And Google, the site everybody uses, almost entirely relies on the text of web pages to figure out what they're about. And I'll give you an example of how that's worked. This is not just a toot my own horn. You saw my guitar before. Okay, if you type cheap guitar into Google and click the first link, you get my web page. Now, why on earth would that be so when I don't sell guitars? It's because a year ago, I went hunting for a new guitar for myself. And I did a rather exhaustive search because I wanted a cheap one that was good. And so I roamed all around town and did all this stuff. And then when I got through the whole process, I said, I'll write it up. Why not? Because I've seen this work before. So I wrote up this big article that talks about all the different instruments I looked at with pictures of them and discussions of what they are and how much they cost and what I thought about them and which one I eventually decided on, this one, and what it's like and how it sounds and all this. So it's a pretty long article, and there are the calluses on my finger from trying all those guitars. So I wrote this up and posted it on my website. And I've had my website going for a while, and people link to it. It's reasonably popular. What it turned out is that a lot of people found this article useful, and they pointed to it saying, you know, here's an article about cheap guitars. And the way Google works, how many of you used search engines before Google? Like, before 1998? Okay. You remember what that was like. You'd type in a search term, and you would get 150 sites that were mostly pornography. And that was because in that time, the search engines on the web, essentially, the machines went out and they tried to find every website they could, and they grabbed all the words from all the websites and stuck them into a big database. And when somebody searched for cheap guitar, they just looked for how many pages had, you know, the words cheap guitar in them and how many times, and the one that had it the most in prominent places came to the top of the list. Problem with that is the porn people and the gambling people and all the other people figured this out and just started putting cheap guitar, cheap guitar, cheap guitar, cheap guitar, cheap guitar at the bottom of their pages, and they came to the top of the list. What Google did is it enlisted all of us in order to figure out what was good. Anybody who builds a website or writes a blog or does anything on the web that links to other things that's on the public web, Google takes that and it says, okay, if we're looking for something about cheap guitars, here are a whole bunch of sites that have linked to something about cheap guitars, and they've all pointed to this site, and they've used the word cheap guitar somewhere in or near the link that they made. So presumably, because all these sites, which I already know are good from previous things, are pointing to this site, it's probably good, a good resource about that. So what it's doing is it's basically using all of our effort as people who build websites, like people like me, on the web, all of our work, we're working for Google for free in order to make their searches better, because every time we point to something, Google goes, ah, that's like a vote. So rather than using machines to figure out what's important, it uses people to figure out what's important and uses the machines to mediate that. And they have other things in the mix, too, like, you know, the occurrences and words and things like that. And for example, I have the word cheap guitar up here in the title bar, and it's also here in the title. Presumably, Google figures this page must actually be about that subject, which it is. So that's this particular example, but this happens all the time. And it's not just in search. What Google is reflecting and what the other search engines are reflecting is that websites that are any good are useful. This page, if somebody's looking for a cheap guitar, this page is actually remarkably useful to them. They might not buy one of the ones I've listed, but I give them a pretty good example of 15 or 20 different kinds of cheap guitars that might be worth buying, and also describe the criteria by which I found them good or bad or whatever. Which means that even if they go through all these and go, well, none of those are what I'm looking for, they'll go, ah, well, at least I know that this and that might be good, and this manufacturer makes things here and whatever else. So when they go out and do their own investigation, they have some background material. So this site is useful. This page is useful. And a useful page is a good page and is a well-visited page. So for you, if you're working on websites, your key task among the team building a website, because it's usually not just one person, is to convince people that they should make the website or the web pages useful, readable, something that people actually want to go to and use. Because ultimately, that's what gets you good search results, that's what gets people visiting you, and that's what accomplishes what you're trying to do. And what that means is you have to think in terms of the people coming to the site, not the organization making the site. A key flaw that you see sometimes in a lot of websites is they're organized around the way the company is organized. So you have the part of the website that has to do with the finance and administration part of the company, and the other part that has to do with the imaging division, whatever that might be. Like, say it's a printer company. They have an imaging division. They have a enterprise and corporate division, they have a finance and whatever division, they have a sales division. If you're going to that website trying to find a printer cartridge, which one of those do you go to? How do you know? You might go, well, sales? Imaging? I don't know. How about if it was organized saying printer supplies? Then you'd go, aha, I go there. So a key thing to make the decision is not to organize a website or a page in accordance with what you want to, or with how you're organized or what you want to accomplish, but with imagining and testing out too what the people coming to the site actually want to do. Do they want to find something? Do they want to have some fun on your site? Do they want to accomplish something? Do they want to buy something? What are those tasks, and build it accordingly and write it accordingly? So that's my key message for when you're dealing with the web. The actual technologies you use are going to change, and they've been changing constantly since, you know, the web is now in its entirety about 14 years old, and as a public thing, about 10. And as a commercial thing, about that maybe a little bit younger. So it's a very, compared to those magazines over there, books, television, radio, many of these other media, the web is very young. And so it's still figuring out, and the people who are building it are still figuring out what works and what doesn't. So it's new territory, and if you get into working there, one way to go is to look and see what successful sites and unsuccessful sites do, what's good, what you find frustrating when you're trying to accomplish something online, and how to avoid that. All those sorts of things are useful. And one of the things that's very good, even if you're just a writer on a team or an editor on a team, is to encourage the people building a site to test their site with real people trying to do real things. Just to grab some people off the street and say, you know, or put an ad somewhere, you know, come down to SFU or whatever and say, we need 3 people or 5 people to come to, you know, our office and just try using our website to do what we think you want to do. And you watch them and you videotape them. And you see where they run into trouble and where they are able to do what you think they could do. And you suddenly go, oh, I totally didn't get that. It's amazing what you can accomplish in that sort of thing. So that's a really useful thing, too. Even if you don't do it yourself, encouraging others on your team to do that is good. Most of this stuff I'm going to skip here. I'm just going to show you two more things. Here's the Mountain Equipment Co-op website and West Beach. Now, West Beach has improved a bit, but this site is what I would call a brochureware site. You get here and you're like, well, I'm looking for Gore-Tex pants. And you go, okay, I can rate my skis, whatever that is. I can get the latest mugshot. I can get the Frosted Flakes trailer. I can read about fresh meat. I can... Oh, there's some pants. Okay, that looks kind of cool. Are those Gore-Tex? It's got lots of pockets. It's worn by the Whistler Blackcomb Terrain Park stamp. Okay, that's good. Oh, now I've lost it. Okay, maybe it's winter 05. Rider stuff. What? Okay, I just want some pants. How do I get pants? Okay, so if I go over here to Mountain Equipment Co-op and I go, men's clothing, waterproof breathables, that's Gore-Tex. Pants. There we go. 3 clicks. There's an example. The West Beach site is trying to be cool. And maybe they don't sell stuff straight off the site anyway, so whatever. Maybe their goals are different. But if people were going to these two sites trying to buy some pants, they're going to buy them at MEC, and they're not going to buy them at West Beach. Because West Beach may look better. It may look cooler at first, and it may be slicker and hipper and whatever else. But I don't really want to rake my steez, whenever that is. I want to buy some pants. And right here, I'm ready to spend my $290 on some expensive pants. Or $165 or whatever. And that's because they have thought about what their users want to do. And they have, you know, good... Think about it as a writer. Being able to write this short chunk that gives everybody everything they need to know about those pants that cost almost $300 is a pretty challenging task. So, you know, that's a good thing to have done there. And you should get some money for that. So, before we finish up... There are 2 things I need to do. One of which is give you the evaluation forms. And the other one of which is to give you your certificate. I didn't know you got certificates. So what I'll do is the certificates are, as far as I can tell, sorted in alphabetical order by last name. So I will pass you both. You can grab your certificate and no one else's, please, and then grab an evaluation form, which you should fill out right now because I guess they want them before the end of the thing. If you didn't get one of these super funky orange pens, you're welcome to take one. The writing and publishing program pens. Looks like I got a highlighter on the back end. Oh, cool. If you didn't get one of those, grab those there. And while you're working on the evaluations, does anyone have any more questions or anything they'd like you to, like me to address?
I'm trying to think, you know, yeah, clearly, as I came to do the exercise,
yeah,
it was far more difficult than when I was listening to you. I mean,
yeah.
My God, I'm barely comprehending this.
Yeah.
And so I think, okay, where do I go with this from here? I'll say I need to do some more practice. I need to do some more work on it. To get to the point where it's, you know, really smooth for me. So
yeah.
I guess my question is, what is this?
Well, I mean, the only reason that this stuff is smooth for me, really, honestly, the only reason that these tasks are easy for me is because I've taught a whole bunch of these seminars. I really didn't get my head deeply into figuring out how this stuff works until I went, oh, I'm going to have to teach people about this, and I'm going to have to be able to answer questions. Before that, I was just stumbling my way through, and I discovered things here and there, you know, these things like the paste unformatted and stuff like that. So the key thing is... the key thing to remember is that whenever you get a client that sends you a document, they know way, 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 way less than you did when you got here today, never mind what you figured out in the several hours since. So anything you do to the document, anything at all, even the most minimal amount of it, is going to be great for them. And, you know, I've gotten documents that I've had, you know, I've left things too late, and I've had a horrible deadline, and I've rushed it through and not really done the job and sort of sent it off going, oh, that was awful, that was terrible, and they come back going, that was fabulous, great, here's your check. And so I think one of the things you need to realize is that as an editor, as a writer, as somebody who's working with these words, you already have the skills just off the bat to make things, and your only job is to make things better. Your job is not to make things perfect, because you can't. So what I would do is, you know, take that same exercise sheet I gave you and look at some of the things that caused you trouble and maybe play around with them. The only way I found this stuff out was because I was trying to do something and I actually got into it. And I looked at that book, that Word in a Nutshell, or any number of these other books, and just figured it out, you know, and then went from there. You could just, if you want to take the CD, you can. If you don't, feel free to. You can drop your evaluation there. I'm going to post the audio. I didn't get some of the second section because something went wrong here, but I've got this bit and the first bit at least, so some of it will be there. That covers a lot of the ground I'm talking about. That whole web page is still there. It has a lot of the tips and tricks in it. And I have pointers to the helps. You know, again, the online help for Word, like the actual on-the-website help, is remarkably good, and you can find a lot of the things you need to do there. And I was even doing that here. Oh, how do I change the language? How do I, you know, change the numbering of the sections? If you just search for, if you know you can do it, then sometimes that's all it takes. Can I get you something? Did you not get one?
Yeah,
of
those? No.
Yeah, no.
Can you sign my certificate?
Am I supposed to sign it?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, I didn't even know we had. Okay, I'll sign it. I think somebody got an unsigned one.
I spelled your name wrong.
Derek Mills. All right, well, fine.
That's hilarious. The evaluations are also for a different course.
Yeah.
Are they? Well.
Oh, no. They are.
If you can write at the top what the correct version, what the correct course is. Or I'll mention it to them.
That's so unprofessional.
Yeah. Well, you see, they should have hired you to look over the certificate and the evaluation form.
Well, I suppose the poor person he's got the other wrong set.
Presumably so.
So there's going to be two sets of wrong ones.
You can have this one. Or there's one here. That? Who else needs a signature? An autograph, so to speak. There we go.
You just wanted to do this again before
the sign over. I didn't know these certificates were gonna happen until they walked in. They said, here's the certificate. Oh, certificate. Oh, you just put it there and I'm not looking at them, so I'll just shove them in the envelope when they're ready.
You're more professional than they are. And you have the wrong.
Okay. Does anybody else need their certificate signed? I have business cards here if you want to take them. Right there. Two different sets that you can use. Use the ones with the flowers. These are my personal ones. The other ones are my business. So feel free to grab that. If you have questions, you can email me. I can't guarantee you that I will have an answer, because I don't always know. But I can maybe point you in the right direction. Well, thanks very much for coming. I had a good time, and I hope it was good for you. There we go. Thanks a lot.